hello there, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 249. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, is Greg Leahy.
Hello.
James Jones.
Hi.
And John Lindemann.
Party people!
So, next week is our five-year anniversary, 250 big fat episodes of this show.
Damn.
And I'll remind you again at the end of this episode, but just in case you're at your computer now and you won't be by the end of the episode, I figured I'd bookend this show with a notice that we are planning to have a live chat event, a live conference call, essentially, where all of our listeners can call in and talk with us, ask us questions, and reminisce about favorite moments on the show. So that's going to be part of what we do for the anniversary episode. We'll also have a pre-recorded section like normal. We'll talk about a few other things as well on that. So we're probably going to try to slam it all together and get it up for the normal publishing schedule next week. So in order to do that, we need to do it earlier on the weekend. So it's going to be in a similar slot as the Child's Play charity telethon that we had last fall. Last winter, really. It was back in December, I think. So anyway, it's going to be on Saturday, July 9th. We're going to start at noon Pacific, which is, of course, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And for all of our European listeners and anyone else around the world who needs to adjust for the time zone, that is 7 p.m. GMT.
We're on daylight time, so it's 8 o'clock in Britain.
That's right. So it'll be 8 o'clock for Greg. It'll be much earlier than normal for him, and much earlier for the rest of us. It'll be midday or the afternoon. So I hope this will reach a large percentage of our audience to give a lot of people an opportunity to dial in. We'll probably go for 1 or 2 hours, depending on how many people are listening, how many calls we get, and how things are going. So it's not going to be a 7-hour thing like last time. It's really going to be pretty freeform. We're not going to come in with a whole lot of prepared topics or anything. We want to hear from you. We want to talk to you. We want to get your thoughts on what's going on in video games right now and field your questions on anything about the show or about Nintendo or about whatever you want to talk about, really.
How it's hanging, son.
We had a lot of requests to have another live show after the telethon, and you know, and of course the PAX East panels are live, but that's difficult for people to come out to. So hopefully doing it on the internet over Skype will be easier. Now, just the basic way that this works is that you'll go to NintendoWorldReport.com and we'll have a page there. It'll be easy to find, trust me, on the front page. But we'll have an article set up with a chat room and then also a live stream, so you can just click on that and listen. And it'll also have all the information for how to call in. And if you do want to call in and talk to us, and I really encourage you to do that, because we would love to, so don't be shy. We're not going to buy it, trust me.
I will.
Just make sure that you have Skype installed on whatever device that you want to use, and that you have a decent microphone or headset. And if you're thinking, well, I don't have a headset, I've never done a podcast, I've never really done any kind of internet chat before, if you have a Rock Band or Guitar Hero microphone, those work pretty well as long as you hold it up close to your mouth. I mean, any USB microphone will do, and that's one that a lot of gamers already have in their homes, and that's what I used at E3 for all of our podcasts that we did there. So it really does work pretty well, actually, if you hold it up close to your mouth, just like on TV, you know? So that's what we're going to do. I hope that will please some of you. I hope you'll participate. Again, that will be next Saturday, July 9th, and I'll repeat some of that information at the end of the show. But, of course, you can always go to the website and find it there as well. So now we're going to get into new business, and James has a game that is not quite out yet.
So we at E3 got to play Solotarobo, because XSEED is going to be releasing it in North America. At the time, they hadn't announced it, so we didn't put our impressions up until they actually came around to announcing it earlier this week, or either at the end of last week. So basically, if you listen to the show, we've talked about it a few times. There's been some posts on the website about it. Essentially, it's a RPG action game in which you control a anthropomorphic dog who pilots a giant robot and throws things at the ground. This is the game.
It's pretty crazy.
That's pretty much the extent of the game. I mean, it takes place on a bunch of flying islands that make up a country. Everybody's anthropomorphic dog or cat. apparently at one point everyone was human and got transformed, and there's a mystery as to why that happened, but everyone seems to just kind of accepted it in a way, but at the same time it's mysterious, although they've kind of been like, yeah, that happened, whatever. You know, that's not taking itself super seriously, obviously.
And this is a DS game, right? 2DS.
Yep, this is a hardcore original DS game with some DSi enhancements that I don't remember what they are.
Yeah, I've been struggling to identify what these enhancements are.
So the problem is, I'm playing the game and wasn't taking notes.
It came out in Japan, you know, as you might expect, several months ago,
yes,
during last year, and it's not particularly easy to find out from the coverage associated with that.
No. Even if you speak Japanese, it's not quite immediately apparent.
You know, I don't, it may have been one of these cases where they just kind of wanted to get the DSi region lock in there. I don't know. Maybe it's really superfluous, but for that reason, I suppose we should be glad that it is coming out in all territories.
Yes, because I would have been forced to play it on the original 2DS. 2DS brick. As opposed to 2DS red brick. So, from the demo, at least, it appears to be a side-scrolling action-y game with heavy RPG elements. It's broken up into stages that our esteemed PR rep from XC described almost as like episodes of a cartoon. So they're somewhat compact, self-contained mini stories that lead into the next one, even including like a bumper at the end for next time on. I actually had a bit of fun with it. I mean, obviously we played the first level, so it's telling me how to throw things, you know, press A again, and now you've thrown them. But there's a little bit of exploration, there's some puzzle solving, there's some platforming. There's a lot of things in this game. Say it's 2.5D, so you can go in and out, but it's mostly, like I said, side-scrolling. The demo featured a couple boss battles that required some variations on combat and some very, very, very light puzzle solving and how to defeat them. It's stunningly beautiful. I mean, it's one of the best-looking DS games I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah, it looks really amazing. I mean, we have impressions on the site with video. I'm looking forward to the game, but I was before I got there, so that's kind of irrelevant. But it didn't dampen my desire to play it more. Let's put it that way.
Sola Torobo is kind of, it's like a quasi sequel to Tail Concerto, right?
Yep.
And that wasn't that like a PS1 game?
Yeah. So there's two games, I guess, technically that it's a quasi sequel to, and I can't remember what the one before Tail Concerto was, but they refer to it as a trilogy, even though they're not true sequels of each other. But they essentially all involve anthropomorphic animals and mechs.
It always seemed to me to be, at least the original Tail Concerto, always seemed to be similar to Mega Man Legends.
I think there might be some similarity there. I mean, I never actually played the original Tail Concerto, so I'm not sure. Ultimately, it's, this game might be a little Mega Man Legends-y, but like I said, it's 2D, so it's not quite the same.
It's like 2D kind of gameplay, but with the graphics are like polygonal, cell-shaded.
Yeah, and you can move in 3D, but the stages are 2D. You're not going to be...
They're designed as a kind of side-scrolling-ish.
Yeah, which I guess it's not really 2.5D then either, because you can truly move in 3D. I'm not sure what you'd call the thing. So this was a Bandai game in Japan, and then Nintendo of Europe announced, I don't know, a while ago, that they were going to be releasing it in Europe.
Yeah, it was about 3 months ago, I think. And it's one of these situations where they're kind of partnering on the distribution and the marketing, while Namco Bandai officially remains the publisher here.
Right.
It's an odd one, because by the time people hear this, the game, Sola Torobo, will be out in Europe, and yet I would forgive them for not being aware of that, because Nintendo's part in marketing the game and stuff, you know, it hasn't been very strong. Apparently, they haven't been sending out a lot of review copies, because there's very few reviews for it online. There's a couple in the print mags, which are pretty favourable, but yeah, I mean, this, I don't know what Namco Bandai is getting for agreeing to this deal with Nintendo, because it is going very soundly under the radar at the minute.
I guess they could argue they would have gotten no sales in Europe otherwise, so maybe that's what they're getting.
Yeah, Nintendo probably just paid for beer or something on the last company outing.
So Nintendo apparently did handle the localization. At least that's what we were told at the Xseed office.
Right, so what's happened is they've helped localize the game, but then they've allowed that localization to be picked up by Xseed in the States.
So yeah, so Xseed is then localizing that localization.
I presume just tweaking like spellings. Or
yeah, removing use, and then maybe the reference we were given is removing a whole lot of the use of the word bloody.
Oh, God.
Like he emphasized, they've removed quite a few of those. But that's basically the extent of the localization, so it's probably one of the easiest games XSEED's ever had. So, yeah, it comes out on the 1st. Yeah, so it actually comes out the day we're recording this for Greg's time, because he's already...
Yeah, it's a matter of a few hours from when we're recording.
Looks like North America's going to get it in September. Obviously, XSEED doesn't quite have the resources, and when we went to their office, they had just inked the deal to get it, like, the Friday before they contacted us, and they contacted us, like, 2 weeks before the show. They seemed happy to get it, and they were very effusive in the praise of the game, which, of course, they would be, but much more so than the other games we saw. And I can see why. I mean, it's not to disparage the other games, but this one was really cool.
All right, James, and what else have you been playing this week?
So I finished Ocarina of Time, which is kind of sad for me because I didn't feel compelled to go collect all the crap I usually get. Usually I get all the bottles, I get as many of the heart pieces as I can remember where they are, I get the ice arrows. I didn't feel compelled to get any of that stuff.
I've been chipping away at the extra stuff, just got, it's when something's portable with a Zelda and a Metroid, I end up being far more completionist with collecting extra stuff than with the console game, because it's just easier to dip into it for sort of no particular reason and end up finding things. Like, I mean, with Minish Cap, I took about 4 years, I think, but I did end up fusing all of the kinstones in the game.
Yeah, that's tough to do, because that is a lot of stuff.
It's a lot of kinstones, and Minish Cap has a tremendously dense overworld. I think it's something it doesn't get enough credit for, is how interesting the overworld is.
Oh, it's awesome. I mean, it's got a great game world.
That's a great game.
But, you know, I mean, with Ocarina now, I've got up to, like, 19 hearts, which is as many as I ever got originally. I'm, like, 4 short of all the heart pieces and all that kind of stuff. So it's just, I don't know, that's the kind of thing I would not dedicate time to.
I see, I actually did get them all at one point.
Oh, did you? I think I was 3 short back in my original file.
But what I ended up finding was that the game is just, you know, I mean, it's still a really good game. I'm not going to disparage its quality, but for whatever reason, it's just not doing it for me anymore. You know, I've played it so many times. I've beaten it so many times. I mean, and that nothing in the game really surprises me. Maybe if I could play it in the flipped mode right off the bat, I'd feel a little bit surprised, because, you know, sometimes stuff happens, you're like, whoa, he's left-handed now, he's right-handed now. But it's ultimately, it's that game shouldn't have been $40, and I'm not sure they really should have devoted all that effort into just making an enhanced port, or they could have made something new.
Right.
Now, do you think because it's sort of an action-oriented game that it kind of, over time, you just get sort of tired of it more than something that's just more narratively focused?
See, I don't tend to replay my RPGs that much, though.
Yeah, I would struggle to imagine playing a lot of RPGs. I mean, Chrono Trigger's, you've got the new game plus thing, so you can basically replay it on speed.
Yeah.
But
I mean, that game really goes above and beyond any other RPG out there.
And it's got all the endings, and it's got incentives, and it's, you know, but for me, a strictly narrative experience is difficult to replay.
Yeah.
So actually, on the topic of doing all the optional stuff in Ocarina, I remember one of the big things in the original version being that you could run around and find the caves that were triggered by the Rumble Pack.
Yes.
So how do they handle that on 3DS, which doesn't have Rumble?
They've renamed the stone. I can't remember what they call it.
The Shard of Agony.
Yes.
And it just pings a little noise and shows an icon in the top of the screen that just gets louder, you know, almost like a little radar thing. That whenever you come across something, it'll let you know that you can bomb it. Or it's not always bombing it. Sometimes playing the Song of Storms, I think.
Yeah, so that does it sometimes.
That doesn't seem like as much fun.
It's not, but there's no force feedback on the 3DS, so I'm glad they did something.
You got to make the best of it, I suppose.
I'm glad they did something. Honestly, what's most disheartening to me is I went in with less hearts to the Ganon fight than I've ever had. I had nothing in my bottles. I had damage already. I was almost out of arrows. And I still won, despite having no preparation whatsoever.
Yeah, it's easy. It's an easy game. I don't know whether it's easier than it was before. I mean, I do remember.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
I do remember dying, you know, when I played it the first time, but that was mostly due to stupidity or stubbornness or unpreparedness or, you know, those sorts of things, which, you, having played the game several times, so it'd certainly be unforgivable for me to make some of those mistakes again.
I went in as totally unprepared as I've... I mean, I didn't prepare for any fucking dungeons. I would just go in there, and what ended up happening was I had one bottle as story required.
Yeah.
So I had two, and I ended up having two fairies for most of the game, not because I went out to find them, but just because I happened to cross them.
And they never got used.
Yeah, and I mean, I literally, as sad as this is, never died playing the game.
No, that's completely plausible the way it is when you know it as well, you know, because
yeah.
I think most of the deaths that I can remember, for, you know, just when you don't know exactly what you're doing and you start trying silly stuff and you just stand there getting hurt or, you know,
yeah.
Whereas, as I said last week, it is relatively straightforward now.
Yes.
And so it's unlikely you're going to kind of run into trouble when you've got that foreknowledge. But I don't think its straightforwardness is altogether a bad thing by any means.
No,
I mean,
it's...
Because, you know, as I've said before, I think stuff like Twilight Princess and Wind Waker are overstuffed. There's something sort of refreshingly lean about Ocarina as it is now, especially with the improved interface. But at the same time, that is not terribly satisfying.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there isn't that much of a sense of an accomplishment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm ready. Like, I enjoyed the game enough. And I still recognize that this game, when it came out, was just unbelievably ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels its age now. I mean, it doesn't feel old, but it feels a little dated. Which, given the fact it's age, is a compliment, I suppose. But I really feel like they needed to do something besides Ocarina of Time at this point.
What I wonder is if Nintendo was, you know, what's the name of the studio that made this?
Gretzo.
I'm not that familiar with them, but I wonder if Nintendo was looking for someone to get their feet wet on doing handheld Zelda games so that they can hand that off, because making a 3DS, a new Zelda for 3DS is going to be a lot more work than making the DS ones was. And Nintendo did those internally, but look at what it did to the schedule for their Wii Zelda game.
The thing is, Gretzo is most known for Nintendo games, at least for Line Attack Heroes.
Yeah, they did come out as a WiiWare game in Japan, but it's headed by the guy that created the Seiken Densetsu series. So I think that's his
Koichi Ishii
claim to fame.
Yeah, so I could see these guys actually, I'm not saying this will happen, but I could see a scenario in which Nintendo let them build some prototypes for a new Zelda game for 3DS, and because of their experience, Nintendo might actually trust them to go ahead and do that, and then that would free up Eiji Aonuma's team to finish Skyward Sword and then move on to make a Wii U Zelda game, which clearly they're already setting people up for with that graphics demo that they had at E3.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, if you want to extend that logic out, I certainly hope that they would be willing to let Q Games make an original Star Fox.
Yeah.
After they're doing the remake.
So, on the subject of Q Games, really quickly, I got to play a little bit of Pixel Junk Side Scroller at E3, a game that I didn't know existed until I picked up the controller and started playing it.
This happens.
Well, they just hadn't really announced it. It was just there. Maybe they announced it the first day of E3, which is a terrible time to announce anything. You know, especially if you're at E3. If you're at home, it's a little bit different. But if you're at E3, you're just way too close to the eye of a hurricane.
Yeah.
I mean, that stuff just gets completely lost. So I was like, oh shit, a new Pixel Junk game. And I go over there, and it's basically like the art style from Pixel Junk Shooter, but done in simulated vector graphics, and it's a pure horizontal shoot 'em up game.
Holy shit.
It's really fast-paced and really hard. I loved it, man. I mean, I'm a sucker for vector graphics, as I've said before, so I'm really glad to see that style being paid tribute to, and it played just silky smooth. The other cool thing is, I mean, it's basically like Gradius, you know, or R-Type, but the interesting thing was you could actually touch the walls without dying.
Huh.
So they were doing some really interesting stuff with the level designs, because there's still a lot of fluids like you have in Shooter, and those can actually hurt you, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes, if it's like water, then maybe it just slows you down. So they're building all this stuff into the paradigm of a very fast-paced shooter that auto-scrolls. It's really, really good, and it just looks amazing. So I had to mention that, because we've talked about a lot of the Pixel Junk games, and that one looks... I think I might be more excited for that than I have been for any of the previous stuff.
That sounds insane.
All right, so James, what was the final game that you had this week?
The last game I had is a DSiWare title called 10 Second Run. It was on Nintendo's eShop, or at least in America, as their bargain games. I think it's the phrase they use for it. So it's games under $2 or 200 DSI points.
Ah.
So this game is basically, it's just a timed platformer. It's a stick figure that runs over these really crudely drawn obstacle courses, then you have 10 seconds to reach the end of each level. It's a lot of platforms, hazards, like fire on the ground that you have to try to get over, moving things that'll hit you in the head and kill you. Graphically, it's really simple, but it's in the first 10 or so stages, I'm like, yeah, this is easy. And then it quickly went to just insidious.
Sounds like a bit like Super Meat Boy.
A bit. You could jump to any of the game's 50 levels and play it whenever you want. I jumped to 50 just to see what it was like and just closed the screen and walked away. So it actually has a running total of how many times you've died on the level, even if you leave and come back, so you can see how terrible you've done. I've got a couple that are in 15, 20 range already.
So this is a DSiWare game that you that's been out for a while, and once you got the eShop working, you're like, I got to go get me some...
So, no, actually what happened was I was just...
Some strange bargain titles.
I was browsing through, because Nintendo has, and at least in America, has all these different categories that changes every week. So I like to go put up what craziness they've put up there in their different categories, because sometimes the categories are like what we've been playing, or crazy action games, or summer vacation. And I decided I was going to go look through, and that week it was bargain titles, and I'm looking through, and that one had a really high rating in terms of stars. They're all kind of skewed high, but that one stood out a little bit, so I went and looked it up online, and it actually had decent reviews, like pretty good reviews, in fact. I'm like, well, it's $2. Of course, this also means that I fixed my 3DS eShop.
Yeah, that's probably the important part of the story.
What was the issue?
So, the issue is painful. So, Nintendo finally put up a real description for that error code I was getting, and it was zip code invalid. So, a logical company would detect, oh, the zip code's invalid. I'm going to give you a screen to re-enter it. Nintendo, fuck that. I'm going to give you a cryptic error message. So I went into the location settings, which is what the instructions on the website tell you to do. Delete your location settings and put them back in. So I go up to the options, settings, in the eShop. Location settings, 3DS freezes. Gone. Hard locked. It is not coming back. I had to power it down manually. Do it again. Same thing. Call the 800 number. Get a human, which is a nice change. I'm immediately transferred to their second level. He goes, uh-oh, hard lock, need to change the system. I'm like, really? He's like, So I went through the stuff I can do. I can browse the internet, I can browse the eShop, I could add money. I just couldn't download anything. So we tried deleting the eShop settings from the flash card, or the SD card, from the 3DS menu. That did not resolve the issue. So then we went, and I, under his advisement, went into the 3DS and basically uninstalled the eShop. Reinstalled it, and it worked. The problem is that Nintendo stores how much money you have on your fucking SD card. I no longer had $10.
How is that not hackable?
It's
encrypted, but fuck. Yeah. Like, that's just saying, here, people, take this card with you and just fuck around with it forever.
It's public-private key encrypted, I'm sure, but still... Yeah. And, of course, the secondary problem here being that I was out $10.
And they couldn't recharge it to you?
I've asked about it, and maybe I'll hear back from them.
Well, I've noticed that if you go in the system settings and you go to the eShop stuff, I mean, you can delete your account information. It tells you that any points you haven't already spent will be lost. But if you did that under the direction of Nintendo customer service...
Yeah.
Then they should refund your money. I mean, they can go and see how much you
have.
Yes. So
we will see if that happens. But Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, God, for the love of God, for the Wii U shop, have a login. I know you don't want to get, like, Sony hacked. But seriously, just have a login. On the bright side, I don't have any sales tax, so that's good.
Hey, Virginia is for lovers and downloaders.
Mm. Little victories. No sales tax.
All right, we got to move on, but I'm very glad you got that fixed, James. So a lot of we'll get some virtual console stuff from you in the future, I guess. Maybe. John, what have you been playing?
Let's see. I actually beat a game over the weekend.
Oh!
Yeah, take a wild guess what genre it was in.
Visual novel.
No, Greg, you're wrong. But that's a hell of a guess.
Horse racing simulation.
No, close.
But you will get to play those on your Wii coming up. Monopoly knockoffs.
No, it was a first-person shooter called Halo 3 ODST, which I bought because I've always been curious about it, and it was on Amazon for like $15. So, you know, hey, count me in. I'm a first-person shooter guy. So, yeah, and it's pretty good. It's very Halo-y. It's not like Halo Reach. The strange kind of thing that I had to kind of figure out switching between the two is that the pickup gun button mapping and the reload gun button mapping are swapped on the two games. So it's really, really weird going back and forth between the two.
Now, I heard the interesting thing about ODST that I always heard, I haven't played it, but supposedly it has some kind of like overworld where you can go talk to people and actually... Now that I think about it, it sounds a little bit like the Carrington Institute.
Well, I haven't seen that. I mean, I played through the whole campaign. It's kind of a weird game in concept because it really is sort of an offshoot. It feels very much like they just wanted to have a Halo game out, and so they're like, okay, well, we don't feel like doing a full-blown game package, so they just kind of made a new campaign. Because what you get is you get the, you know, disc one, which is the campaign, which has the Gears of War style swarm or horde mode or whatever they call it in Halo. It's firefight. That's on disc one. And then on disc two is the actual online component of Halo 3. So you can play.
It's on separate discs.
Yeah, it's on a separate disc. It's really weird. Holy so crap. It's just, I guess it tries to cover every base for those people what? That didn't have Halo 3 at the time. They could play the Halo 3 online.
The sad thing is, at that point, they could have just given you all of Halo 3. Since it's on a separate disc anyway,
yeah,
they could have just given you Halo 3 in the box.
Yep.
And instead, they're like, no, we don't want to hurt our catalog sales.
Yeah, I mean, and so in terms of, you know, the actual campaign mode, it's kind of interesting. It's a little bit, it feels a little bit disjointed because, you know, the whole thing is you're an orbital drop shock trooper or whatever, and, you know, as things typically happen in sci-fi first-person shooters, you're going to attack a planet. You're fighting the Covenant. They've already invaded Earth or whatever, and you're going to counterattack. And so you're up in orbit, and you get dropped down to the planet. But of course, things go horribly wrong.
Well, they always go horribly
wrong. They always go horribly wrong. Amazingly enough, yes, in Halo 3 ODST, things go horribly wrong, and you get separated from the rest of your troop. So you get thrown down into the city, and you are the rookie, quote unquote, the rookie. That's who you play. Halo, often known for its very in-depth characters.
Right.
But yeah, so kind of the way it works out is everything relates to the drop time. So everybody dropped down at one point, and the rookie drops for whatever reason 6 hours after everybody else, and so he's kind of lost. And so the whole game is about trying to find everybody, get the band back together. And what it does is it splits off. As the rookie walks around the city at night, he'll go around and find some kind of artifact or a gun or something else that one of his other squad people have left behind. And, you know, he'll pick that up and then it'll cut to that person's kind of story sort of thing. So it's constantly going from rookie to this person, rookie to that person, rookie to that person, just kind of going through until you finally all meet up at the end and win the day kind of thing.
Does he get to run them over with his car by accident?
Yes. Yes, good. As a matter of fact, he does. Yeah, I mean, the couple of main things, I mean, it's, you know, anybody that's played a Halo game, it plays very much like them. You're fighting sort of the older Halo-style enemies. So there's a lot of areas in the game where, like, even compared to something like Reach, where you're actually kind of up against enemies that really, really could kill you pretty quickly, like the hunters especially, that chase you. And so, you know, they kind of, like, stalk you around the map, like you're in kind of a closed-in area. But some of the parts where the game falls down is it does get repetitive because you can tell that, again, that they kind of tried to turn the game around pretty quickly because pretty much the entire game takes place on the same map. So even though you switch to a new character and you have different objectives, you're still in the same part of the map. So there's not a lot of variety going towards the end of the game. But yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, I've enjoyed it. You know, outside of the kind of remapping sort of weirdness compared to Reach, it's certainly not nearly as good as Reach. It's worth a playthrough. You know, it has a couple of cool wrinkles, but I must say, though, I had to bring this up for Greg. I thought of him when I was playing because, you know, of course, like every other first-person shooter out there, it has these kind of in-combat quotes, these gems of wisdom that the NPCs give you.
Mindless babble time.
This one isn't too bad. You get a lot of stuff is kind of hokey, space mariney, kind of like hoorah kind of stuff. that's corny and you kind of know it's corny, but there's one that's like, it's funny because it says it really, really slowly. He's like, I am going to rip out your heart and show it to you before your dying eyes. And that's it. So you're in the middle of this battle fighting. And he's like, you'll kind of walk towards somebody. He's shooting at some alien. I am going to rip out your heart and show it to your dying eyes. And I'm just like, what?
That's stunning.
I was like, right
that's
on.
Awful.
Yeah.
Someone needs a writing class.
It was pretty funny.
Just one class.
Well, it must feel good to start a game and finish it.
Yeah, and that's probably why I've become a first-person shooter guy, is because I can, you know, kind of sit down and power through it.
The campaigns tend to be pretty short.
Yeah, the campaigns are pretty short.
Well, I would like to have that feeling, because I've started a number of games lately that I haven't finished, that I'm still playing through kind of in parallel, a lot of my 3DS. And that's partly because when the eShop launched, I bought about 8 games at the same time, so... Mm-hmm. You know, and I want to try them all, but like some of them I'm trying not to play until I finish other games, but then those other games turn out to be kind of long. The one that I cracked open this week and finally started playing is Shantae: Risky's Revenge. It's the most expensive game I've bought on the eShop. I think it's $12.
Yeah.
But from what I've seen so far, I'd say it's probably worth it. It's clearly a game that they kind of wanted to do as a full retail release and then looked at the market conditions and said, well, that's probably not going to work out, so let's do it on DSiWare. I mean, it has that feel of the production values are very high. I'd say they're higher than most actual retail DS games. And, man, the art style is just so spectacular. I always expect good 2D sprites from WayForward, but I think Shantae is actually probably the best that I've ever seen from them. I mean, this looks better than A Boy and His Blob on Wii. It's more colorful, it's more lively, it may not have as much animation per character, but it just has more personality. There's a lot more characters in it, so there's just a lot more opportunity to bring out weird and interesting and funny character designs. And yeah, a lot of the characters are basically like teenage-looking girls with big breasts. One's a half genie, one's a zombie, one's a pirate, but they all have big boobs that are kind of popping out of their tops, and, you know, clearly someone on the team has kind of a particular taste. But but there are a lot of other characters of many different styles that look very different from that, and some of them, the writing is actually pretty clever, and the art is just very amusing overall, and it just looks really, really, really good. I mean, even on pause screen, but especially in motion, because everything is kind of waving back and forth and moving a little bit. I mean, the only thing I've seen that I could really compare it to is probably Muramasa, which again is a Wii game. So the fact that this looks so good on the DS is very impressive. And from the game design standpoint, I mean, I expected to like it because everybody had compared it to kind of like a Metroidvania thing. It's more like the Castlevania series, I would say, in that there's a lot of earning money to buy things in shops, and there are teleport points and things like that. The game doesn't feel that much like Metroid, but certainly it is similar to Monster Tale and Henry Hatsworth, more like Monster Tale. But I'd say the tightness of the gameplay is more in line with Henry Hatsworth. It's in the sweet zone for me for sure. I'm really, really enjoying it. I've heard that it's very short. I mean, I haven't beaten it yet, so I don't really have a good feel for how long it is. But
well, at one point, they were talking about doing it as like a sort of episodic kind of deal, weren't they? Releasing it in parts.
Yeah.
And they would be, I don't know whether that was, you know, as you said, trying to sort of reclaim an aborted retail project and then put it into sort of chunks, and then eventually they just boiled it down to one chunk.
Yeah, which I think was a smart move, because episodic really only works if you can sort of buy the season, or if you at least have the opportunity to buy the season ahead of time like Telltale does it. Because otherwise what you do is you release the first episode and all the people who are curious about it go out and buy it. And for some people, it's an entry point into the whole series, and they get really hooked on it. And for a lot of other people, it's a paid demo. And I'm sure that there's just this precipitous drop-off in the sales as they march through a season.
Well, and I mean, there's also the issue of keeping up the regularity of the updates. I mean, you know, this Sonic the Hedgehog 4 situation is pretty laughable. I mean, you know, we've had episode 1 out for several months now, and then
they're going to release three or four retail Sonic games before Episode 2 ever comes
out. Between episodes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
If it ever comes out.
That's pretty ridiculous.
So anyway, Shantae's really good, and I'd say, you know, if you've got a 3DS and you've been kind of going back and wondering which DSiWare game should I buy, because you never had one before like me, Shantae is really impressive. Just, I say, go watch a video of it, and then you'll probably want to pay for it. Because the game looks so impressive. I knew in theory that it looked really nice, but once I actually started playing it, I was like, oh shit, this looks awesome. So the other thing that I wanted to talk about this week, I've been playing some Link's Awakening, but I don't have anything really revelatory to say about it, other than I do think it's really weird that it's a Zelda game in which you jump a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd played it before, but I'd forgotten that the Rock's Feather is basically the first item that you get.
Yeah, and you use it heavily.
You use it a lot. And, I mean, if you're pausing and going to the subscreen, which you do about every 15 seconds, there's about a 50% chance that you're going to grab the feather.
Yeah.
So it's just weird that this is a top-down Zelda game with a shitload of jumping in it, and they haven't really done that since, I don't think. I mean, it's in the Oracle's games, but...
Yeah, and you had the cape in Minish Cap right towards the end where you could jump and fly, but it was right at the end.
So the game actually makes a lot of use of the jumping, too. I mean, they use it heavily in puzzles and in...
Side-scrolling bits, you know, you could jump on Goombas with it and...
Right, I think it makes the side-scrolling parts actually work, because those parts were... very perfunctory in the original Legend of Zelda. You basically would go down a ladder and then go up, and it was just an item holding room, you know?
Yeah.
It was just, this is how they give you the blue ring, is they put it in this room. There might be one enemy in there, but usually there wasn't even that. So I think giving you the feather now opens up those side-scrolling levels to become really interesting parts of the game, whereas they weren't really before.
Oh, and what I also thought was always kind of interesting about those items is that they would use it in combination with other things, too. Especially the Pegasus boots, obviously. But,
yeah, right. The running jump.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other really cool thing about Link's Awakening is that you can actually unequip the sword and put something else. And that was partly a limitation of the hardware because the GBA only had two buttons and they wanted to do a fairly advanced Zelda game with it. You know, they wanted to kind of replicate the complexity of A Link to the Past, but with a third as many face buttons. And because of that, you know, I think along with Metroid 2, even though they've already remade it once as the DX, you know, the color version that's up on the eShop now, the one that I've been playing, but I think this game would actually really benefit from being on a system with more buttons, where you could actually change the interface, allow you to carry more than two items at a time, let you use a touchscreen or something comparable to switch items so that you don't have to pause the game so often, which is a real issue. And, you know, other than that, I mean, the game design is great. There's a few things like the map, I would say, is my biggest problem. The map has so little detail that it's almost useless. So I would like to have much, much better maps, something that's actually useful to help you find the seashells. And I also think there should be a lot more teleport warp points because they're so spaced out that they're not even really all that practical.
It's not a giant world, but yeah, there could be a few more.
It's not a giant world, but like Minish Cap, it's a very dense world. And, you know, often getting across five screens requires going to the subscreen and switching items four times. So being able to teleport with a little more precision would be really useful.
You just need that damn bird. Fly yourself there.
Yeah. That is helpful, actually, later on. I started to use it in place of swimming.
Yeah.
To just pick up the rooster because it's about three times faster. And you can actually pick him up out of the water.
We gonna fly.
Well, the other thing I wanted to mention this week is that I had a request on Twitter from Jet Pilot, who's a listener, and he's written in quite a few times.
He's a jet pilot.
Supposedly.
I hope.
According
he better
to his
be.
Name. And Jet Pilot asked if we could talk about Retro Game Master on the podcast. So this is Game Center CX, the TV show, of which Retro Game Challenge, the DS game, is based on the TV show. And the reason that he asked us to talk about it is because Kotaku, the website, has started localizing the TV show from Japan. And I think the first two episodes should be up by the time you hear this. It was Ninja Gaiden, and then they were going to do...
Fantasy Zone, isn't it?
Oh, wow, yeah.
Super Fantasy Zone or something?
I have Super Fantasy Zone, I think, on Virtual Console. It's a weird game. So yeah, they started with Ninja Gaiden, and this episode is actually from season 4 in Japan. And I don't know why, I guess they're maybe they're going to do like a best of, and they're kind of selecting their favorite episodes and choosing to localize those first, rather than try to do it in some kind of chronological order. Ninja Gaiden is I think a funny and a good choice for the first English episode, because it's a game that most Americans are probably familiar with. I mean, it was very popular in America on the NES, and that's the version that he's playing. And it's such a brutal game. I mean, it's just legendarily famous. Whereas, like, you know, it's on the same order as, like, Takeshi's Challenge. But that's a game that, in the English-speaking world, there's so little familiarity with Takeshi's Challenge that, you know, that episode might be funny, but it wouldn't have the parts where he's playing through, like, the third level where the eagles start coming in and knocking him out of the middle of a jump. And it doesn't have that recognition, like, oh, I know that part, that's so awful, I totally, you know, understand his pain. So anyway, if you're not familiar with Game Center CX or Retro Game Master, the idea of the show is that this guy named Areno, for some reason, I don't know what the premise is, because this is a late episode, so they don't actually explain it, they just jump into it. But this guy is on a mission to replay, or to play through and to actually beat and complete a lot of old classic video games, console games. And so he goes through and he does some Master Systems things, probably. Some, I don't know if he gets into Super Nintendo and Mega Drive in that era, but there's a lot of Famicom stuff for sure, and probably older than that too. So the idea of Ninja Gaiden is that he's never played this game before. He's played some similar games from that era, but he's never actually played Ninja Gaiden for some reason. And he's also not very good. Like, he's just not a very skilled gamer, and I guess his main feature is that he's patient, because they end up spending 16 hours to beat Ninja Gaiden, a game that if you actually went through it without dying, you could beat it in probably an hour. I mean, yeah. It's not a long game. There's not that much content. It's just so brutally difficult, and I mean, this episode is kind of, I found it to be almost like uncomfortable in the way of, like, Ricky Gervais in The Office. Like, it's so painful to watch that it's funny, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it's really kind of awkward and uncomfortable, because this guy is just pathetic. Like, I felt so bad for him, you know? I mean, the game ends with 3 bosses in a row that you have to beat without dying, and if you do die, it takes you back 5 levels to 6-1. It takes you back to the beginning of the world, which is at least 20-30 minutes of gameplay, and that's if you actually do it without running into a lot of problems. And I mean, these bosses are just ridiculous, you know. They're almost like basically the Famicom version of Bullet Hell, where they're just spraying fireballs and shit at you, and your character, you know, can't jump very high. And oh man, it's such an evil, evil game. And it's interesting because it first shows, I mean, when he first starts the first level, he doesn't even know how to climb up walls. You know, he doesn't understand how the wall jumping works. He's really never played the game before. He's learning the controls. He doesn't know how to use the ninja magic, the ninpo. And I'm kind of laughing at it because I can play through the first 5 or so worlds of Ninja Gaiden in about an hour. Like, I know the game well enough that I can see the patterns. I don't have them memorized necessarily, but I recognize them when I get to them, and I can work them out pretty quickly, and I'm pretty good with the controls. But I've never beaten that game. I will never beat that game, ever. It's not happening. Unless I use a Game Genie code or something that makes me invincible, I'm not going to go through that hell. There's just no reason to do it. But that's the premise of this show. He has to make himself do it. And it's so masochistic that it's funny. And it is a very humorous show. And the guy has a pretty good mood about him. Like, he's like, okay, we're going to do this. Like, he tries to stay positive. But in the face of a game like Ninja Gaiden,
yeah.
He just looks so defeated at so many points, you know. He's just like...
That game is so cruel. Oh God!
It is cruel as the word.
Yeah. Again, like it's so cruel that it's poorly designed. Cruel. Like, how could anybody design this and think it was fun? Cruel.
No, I think it's actually intentionally cruel. I think they I think they knew how evil it was.
Yeah.
And they actually did everything possible to make it as hard as humanly possible.
That goes back to the old coin eater style of games, where we're going to make this game so evil that you will blow thousands of quarters on it.
Even though it was totally different from the arcade game, that's the weird thing. Right?
Exactly. You know,
it was an arcade Ninja Gaiden. It's nothing like the NES game, and yet it still has that quarter muncher mentality. That was the way games were. You know, the game design, I guess, just hadn't fully branched off into the console era at that point. But what's really cruel is the fact that if you're outside of America, you can't watch these on Kotaku. They block it on the region basis. So.
It's a licensing thing.
I mean, I get to watch a certain amount of games at CX without any words on the Nintendo channel on my Japanese Wii.
So there are a few episodes that have been fan-translated on YouTube, and they're just subtitles.
Yeah.
But I watched the Takeshi Challenge episode once, and that was pretty amusing. But it's a little bit harder to follow. The nice thing about the Kotaku version is that basically they've dubbed over the narration. So they have an English speaker narrating the whole thing, and that helps a lot. It just makes it – it's a fast-paced show, so it helps you stay involved in it. Although – this narrator, they need to train him a little bit on how to pronounce Japanese names, because...
Oh, that would get to me.
It's the first episode, so there's room for improvement. And then whenever the people on the screen, mostly Areno, but occasionally his producer will come in and give him tips, or they'll bring in a super player to help him out on a particularly difficult part. Whenever those guys are speaking, it's subtitled, which I think is the right way to do it. That way they don't have to find 10 different voice actors, and you know,
it's the
Iron Chef approach.
Yeah,
basically.
The Iron Chef approach, where we're gonna do one guy.
Yeah, and actually the editing of the show reminded me a lot of Iron Chef. So if you like the Japanese version of Iron Chef, the good version, then I think you'll appreciate this. It's pretty low budget, but it's such a great concept for a TV show, and obviously it speaks to our generation and our interests. You know,
so this guy, so he can beat these games. There's no time crunch for him. He can take as long as he wants to beat these
Basically,
games.
He can take as long as he wants, but I think there seems to be, at least in this episode, there seems to be a rule that if he can't marathon through it in one session, I mean, the first day he plays it for over 12 hours. That's why I told James, you really need to watch this, because I think you'll appreciate it more than the average person. But yeah, the first day he plays it for about 12 hours, and he gets to the first final boss, and eventually just basically gives up. And decides to come back another day, but he can't just leave it on overnight. He actually has to turn the system off and take the cartridge with him bring it back and start over from scratch.
That's evil.
He goes through it a lot faster the second day because he's done it before. I mean, you can imagine the feeling of defeat that you're at the final boss and it's taking you 12 hours, and it's like, I need to go home and get some sleep, and he actually has to turn it off.
But that's the thing, probably, like, as kids, we pretty much put 16 hours into that game.
Sure.
If not more.
Yes, it's really good stuff, actually. It brought back a lot of memories of how I used to play video games when I was a kid, and yet at the same time, it's just so masochistic watching this guy do something that really is inadvisable. Let me tell you right now, I do not recommend trying to beat Ninja Gaiden. I recommend playing it. It's a fun game. It's humorously evil, and unlike Super Ghouls and Ghosts, you can actually get past the first stage and see more of the game.
No, I think that just applies to you, Johnny. You do realize that. You're making that common mistake of yours, which is conflating yourself with everyone else.
Because how many people here have beaten that game?
I've beaten Super Ghouls and Ghosts. John, I think, has. James, you've beaten it. I'm beating Ninja Gaiden. I'm beating fucking Ghosts and Goblins.
I have to imagine there's an episode of the show about Ghosts and Goblins, if not Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
Well, that game is off the rails.
Super Ghouls and Ghosts is cruel but fair. Cruel but fair.
Yeah, Ninja Gaiden is cruel and unfair.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's the big hook for me.
But it's a lot shorter.
Yeah.
It has to be, because they would have never been able to test the final levels.
Well, one thing you'll find with me in a lot of like old school 2D games is that as long as the controls are tight and reliable and they click with me, I will put up with a lot of bullshit on enemy placement. And that goes with Mega Man games and Castlevania games and a lot of other things.
I love bad enemy placement.
I mean, we've had this conversation before. I will back off saying that Super Ghouls and Ghosts has terrible controls, but I don't like them at all. they do not feel right to me, and I can't get on board with them. And because of that, I don't care how fair you guys say the game is designed, I just can't play it. So I would much rather play Ninja Gaiden, but I know when to quit, and that's the difference between me and Areno. So this is also another good time to plug Retro Game Challenge. You can find it on your Nintendo DS. It is balls to the wall awesome. And I don't know if the fan translation of the sequel is still going along, but I hope it is. We'll try to find out and give you guys an update at some point. All right, and Greg wraps up new business.
Yep. Well, first of all, I did this week, you know, just to blend in with the whole Ninja Gaiden vibe, I did go back to Kirby's Epic Yarn.
Nice.
Yeah, they're so similar.
Pretty much the same thing. And I did just want to kind of collect some of the treasures that I'd missed and stuff. I mean, it's really quite easy to get gold medals the first time through, the way that is. I mean, the first time I played it, I did play it quite carefully. I wanted to get a high score as I can. And there's lots of like extra little areas where you can collect more beads or whatever. And to be honest, I think they could have done with either having like a platinum medal or setting the gold medal higher as a threshold.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of clever little things that you could do to find stuff that you just don't have to get gold, because the threshold is as low as it is. So I think that's a bit of a shame. But in terms of the treasures I was kind of looking to get here, so like the CDs and the little bits of furniture and stuff, just for the sake of finding them. And obviously they're not as cleverly hidden as the stuff in Wareland Shake or anything like that. But I still wanted to find them. And I think the thing that's kind of refreshing about doing something like this, you know, compared with getting the star coins in a new Super Mario Brothers or something like that, is because Kirby can't die, you can just race through the levels quite literally with his little car, beep, beep, all the way. All of a sudden, how careful I was originally because I didn't want to drop in a pit and lose my beads, or I wanted to make sure I found everything. When you're just looking for one thing and you know generally it's probably going to be this area of the level, you just race through completely uninhibited, and that makes the whole process quite quick and joyous, especially given how pleasant the game is in general. It's, you know, the music and the visual. So that was very enjoyable little thing to do. I've found everything now. Obviously, I haven't done all those mini game things.
No, but why would you?
Exactly. That's quite another thing entirely. So I feel like I've basically 100%ed that game at this point. But what I've been playing mostly is new play control Pikmin for Wii, because E3 was the stake through the heart for an original Pikmin game on Wii. So I thought, well, I may as well get one of the new play control ones now. I quite feel like playing some Pikmin. And of course, in Europe, you have the choice of the second one, because they did actually release that as a new play control here.
Because they hate us here.
Yes. Well, you got Excitebots instead. And I would have taken Excitebots instead. I did take Excitebots instead, because I own that game. you know, Pikmin 2 is obviously an excellent game. The thing is, it's a little harder to find. I think it was a much more limited run than the original and new play control, so it's a little harder to find, a little more expensive to find, because I was able to get the original Pikmin new play control for a fiver. So, yeah, very, very cheap, brand new.
Well, you don't have all those Americans importing it.
Maybe. With this, you know, I guess one of the nice things about getting the original was that that was the one I hadn't played in absolutely ages. It had been nearly 10 years. So it's a bit of a nostalgia trip in a sense. But also playing through it again, you know, with the new controls, which are, they're very good. I mean, it's very well suited. Definitely using the pointer for identifying where you want to throw the Pikmin. You could resolve the whole issue of not having the C-stick, but like you can just use the pointer but hold down on the D-pad. And so that little jingle plays when you want to direct the Pikmin in a particular direction. That's how you do it. Just to hold down the D-pad while gesturing with the pointer, that works fine. And you know, just play through it. It did make me realize just how much they added with the second one. I mean, it's a lot of stuff. I mean, you've got, first of all, Louie having the second character there, and you can switch between, you know, sort of two squads of Pikmin, which certainly, you know, would seem like it could have some interesting applications where they do bring it out for Wii U, you know, because you could have one on the one screen and one on your controller. That could be interesting to see how they use it there, but here it's just Olimar on his own. You know, the enemy sort of designs are a lot more sort of straightforward and simple. You have a lot more kind of elaborate kind of boss type designs in Pikmin 2, like that sort of wraith that's got rolling pins. There's an absolute bastard in the second one, and there's loads of really amusing boss designs in the second one that, yeah, they show up in that little, like, Pikmin encyclopedia where it explains about their biology and all that kind of weird stuff. So with this, obviously, because it was, you know, close to a launch game and all that, it's much more bare bones, but still, the fundamentals are very, very sound, and it's very enjoyable go through it again when you haven't played Pikmin for such a long time. And it's sad that, you know, you're not going to get an original Pikmin game on Wii. I mean, it'll benefit a lot from HD, I think.
Yeah.
Of course, with the great. But I would say this look, you know, when I played the original Pikmin and Pikmin 2 for that matter, I played them through S-Video on old school TVs. So widescreen with the progressive scan and all that, especially when you're kind of playing from the more zoomed out view. It still holds up rather well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's been certainly more than worth £5. I certainly had a much smoother experience with the whole day system this time. Last time I actually, it became quite exciting as I managed to do it on literally the last day.
Oh, yeah.
This time I knew what I was doing and finished with more than a week to spare.
Yeah, you can. If you know what you're doing, you can beat it pretty quickly. But that's the thing. The first time you play it, you won't know what you're doing. And I'd venture to say very few people beat it the first time they go through the third
day. I just kind of resigned myself originally to not being able to do it. And then all of a sudden I kind of looked at it, so I've got 5 days left. If I can get these two parts in on one day, you know, it's not out of the question. And then I actually ended up doing it. You know, it's a crazy, like, rush on that very last level where, you know, if you're trying to kill the Emperor Bulblax or whatever it is and bring back the part on the same day, That was tense. It actually worked out brilliantly. It was so exciting. But, you know, this time they did help you out. I think you could actually go back to your save from any given day. So I guess if you look back at things and thought, God, you know, all started to go wrong about here, you could go back.
It's kind of like Radiant Historia.
Nope, you did it wrong. Bam.
Not have to rip everything up and go absolutely back to day zero, but, you know, instead just undo the damage from perhaps a few particularly unfortunate days.
All right, well, that wraps up new business, so now we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk a little bit maybe about the Xenoblade situation, and then we'll get into your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Andrew Brown has a review of AFL, an unnecessarily competent Australian rules football game for Wii.
Yeah, because it's the only Aussie rules football game on the Wii, but it's surprisingly good.
Yep.
Neil has a review of Transformers on the 3DS. Shockingly, not good.
It might be better than the movie.
But the movie's terrible, so.
That doesn't mean you should play it.
Yep, and unfortunately, you can't take it with you.
You can't.
Matt Blunden has a review of Wii Play Motion. Surprise, surprise, it comes with a controller. And Neil has a review of Resident Evil The Mercenaries 3D. It's really good, at least once.
I wrote that.
That was like a passive-aggressive read right there. It's really good, at least once. Johnny, you suck.
All right. Next up, we've got Josh's review of Mystery Case Files, the Wii version. So now you can do pixel hunting on your Wii with bigger pixels.
The Malgrave incident, to be clear.
We also have Neil's review of Cubic Ninja, which is a rare 3DS release this time of year. By the way, it's another 3DS game you should not buy. It's bad. And it's bad in very unusual ways that are worth reading about.
Next up, we have a quick reminder of James' impressions of Solitarobo Red the Hunter, where you can read more about this beautiful DS game from Japan that we discussed earlier. And finally, we have Carly's editorial called Xenoblade Disaster Strikes Again, in which she looks at the global status of this highly anticipated JRPG that probably won't be released in America.
Well-researched with an amazing abstract, let's put it that way.
All right, well, of course, in addition to all this original content, you'll want to check out NintendoWorldReport.com for all the latest gaming news as well. We've recently had reports on the Dragon Quest X trailer that's going to come out in Japan soon, so definitely go check that out as well. And we are back with the second part of Radio Free Nintendo. Before we get to your emails, thought we would briefly go over the big news story of the past week, which has been the confirmation, essentially, from Nintendo of America that they have, quote, no plans, unquote, to release Xenoblade or The Last Story or Pandora's Tower in North America. There's been the advent of a letter-writing campaign called Operation Rainfall, which is basically asking fans to write personalized letters that will be, I guess, delivered either by hand or digitally, I'm not sure, to the people at Nintendo of America who make these decisions. And there's been a lot of news coverage of all this stuff. And we also got a release date for Xenoblade in Europe. It's going to be on, what, September 9th?
September 2nd.
Yeah, with okay. The red... Is it a red Classic Controller Pro that it comes with?
Yeah, there's a bundle with a red Pro.
Oh, nice.
What a kick in the nuts that is.
And, like, if you pre-order it, you get, like, some signed posters and shit. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
So, and actually, the same day, Nintendo felt the need to respond to all their fans with a tweet.
Nicely done, PR department.
Yeah.
Nintendo of Australia also announced they were getting the game. So Nintendo of Europe and Australia had their announcements, and then Nintendo tweeted to all their fans, "We appreciate all your enthusiasm. You're still not getting this game."
Well, they haven't said it. They're playing it kind of like a presidential candidate. What they're saying is, "We have no plans at this time to release these games." That doesn't mean their plans couldn't change tomorrow.
And we never know their plans, ever.
Right, and that's the thing. Like, they're not going to talk about these games until they make an official announcement. So even if they were already prepping the press release to go out next Monday saying, hey, we're going to do these in October, they still would say the same thing. They're going to say, we have no plans. We have nothing to announce at this time.
If they were prepping the press release, they just wouldn't have responded right away. They would have let the "we'll get back to you" tweet they initially put out stand.
But they were also basically echoing stuff that Reggie had said during some E3 interviews, which is that we have no plans to release those games. Obviously, if we did, we would have fucking talked about them at E3.
Or at least put the logo up. I mean, that was the thing, wasn't it? You know, at the end of the conference with the new console, it was a very full conference. You wouldn't necessarily expect that sort of thing to get in there, but they had all these logos of the Kirby DS game, Mass Attack, and Rhythm Heaven, and, you know, a lot of stuff that's a bit more obscure. And, of course, when Xenoblade, Last Story in particular, weren't on that wall, that was kind of the first hint of this kind of situation brewing. And then you had, was it the comments that came out that there was a Nintendo France executive at E3 who basically said, we've got Xenoblade, but we can't really show you anything because, you know, this is Nintendo of America's event and they won't have stuff here that they're not planning to sell, I think was the how the phrase was kind of translated.
It'll be at Gamescom.
Xenoblade's already been shown at Expos.
Yeah, they've already shown it.
I've heard a little bit of the voice acting, which is all British accents and stuff. It's a bit weird.
Yes,
Dragon Quest VIII style.
It does sound as though this has been, you know, localized with Nintendo of Europe supervision as opposed to anyone else's, which, you know, is a bit different, say, for instance, from the disaster situation where the game was already in English, the voice acting anyway.
Yeah.
It came that way.
So this is definitely more of an undertaking for them. And one thing that's occurred to me, you know, sort of roundabout way for me, who's in Europe, worrying about NOA's attitude towards it, is I do wonder whether this scale of localization might be a bit much for whoever they've entrusted it to, because, you know, NOA, you know, the Treehouse and all that kind of stuff, they're very good. Europe, you know, this kind of relatively trailblazing, I hope it turns out all right. Now, I mean, from a voice acting point of view, they've got both the Japanese tracks and the British-sounding English tracks. So you can go with the subtitles, but that's still a localization issue. You know, is the script well done? You know, we talked about Other M not being daring enough with the localization, you know, not sort of de-Japanifying it enough, if you will.
Well, it's also just done kind of unprofessionally, I would say.
So if they're a bit too conservative with adapting, you know, localization is more than translation. So, you know, you want to take some of that real sort of one-to-one Japanese-ness out of it. I am worried about that aspect of the game, to be honest, and I would be more sanguine about it if NOA were involved, but, you know, clearly they're not.
I think NOA has localized a monolith RPG before in Baten Kaitos Origins.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been there.
Exactly. That's why I'd be reassured.
They could also just hire someone like 8-4 to do it externally, which they did with Dragon Quest VI, which Nintendo published in America.
I mean, they might have done that. I mean, we don't know for sure.
Yeah, we don't know who NOE's bringing in, but that's the point, you don't know.
So localizations for NOE are actually a rather bigger deal because they have to deal with all the European languages as well.
It'd be exactly. A lot bigger effort.
I mean, they only have voice acting for English and Japanese, but I think it was five languages they have subtitles for?
Yeah, typically you have five languages. With something this big, I guess maybe, you know, there's a possibility they might renege on that, but typically it's five.
I think they got the five big ones this time. And I mean, that's, I assume you push it to one language, presumably English, and then you push it from that language to all of the others. But still, that's a lot of translation work that has to be done.
And this is why, you know, this sort of situation is so strange. It was unthinkable, you know, back in the 16-bit era where America would get some of the Squaresoft RPGs or Enix RPGs from Japan, and then Europe would tend to get rather fewer than even that.
A subset of those.
Yeah, because of that problem, you'd have relatively big scripts translate those again into the other European languages away from English. So, you know, the fact that we're at this point now is kind of wacky, to say the least. In America, it seems to be passing, and Europe is actually getting it. Because of course, the other thing is that perhaps jumping the gun a little bit, there's been pretty much a confirmation that Europe will get the last story as well.
Mm-hmm. From the same gentleman.
I wonder about the wisdom of that from the point of view that how many people might say, well, I could just not buy Xenoblade and wait for last story because I think that looks more interesting. I think some people will be of that mindset. So,
well,
I would have preferred, if I were Nintendo of Europe, to play that one coy until Xenoblade's out and has sold, you know, much of what it's going to sell.
Oh, it's funny because I've seen the Wii release lineup for Q3 in Europe, and it doesn't have a lot of competition.
Well, there is that. Yeah, if you want something then, that's it.
Well, yeah. That's not true because there is Champion Jockey, G1, Gallop, and Race.
Which is a very close substitute.
Yeah, I mean, I've just been trying to figure out exactly what the deal is, why NOE is getting these games and America is not. I've been trying to wrap my head around that.
It depends on your point of view. I mean, you do have to wonder whether, you know, NOE is being commercially sensible. I mean, you can look at it that way. I mean, some of the stuff they've brought over... Jam with the Band is a perfectly fine game. I own it. I like it. A lot of our staff owns it.
Likes That's right.
It.
1/3 of its sales were to American NWR staff.
But it seems like that bombed pretty bloody hard.
And that's actually a pretty conservative game, if you think about it. I mean, it sort of fits that expanded audience stuff that Nintendo was...
You would
was...
think so, yeah. You'd think it'd be a pretty good fit. There would be a market for it on DS. That seemed like it struggled. You know, another Code R... which was, you know, sort of taking a handheld, you know, visual novel type of game onto the Wii. That didn't seem like it did very well. That was a lot of translation. You know, it was a very text-heavy game with the five languages. You've done this kind of stuff, and you know they keep doing it now, and it seems to be scaling up. Certainly, you know, Xenoblade Last Story, they've got, you know, a certain amount of cachet behind them because of the RPG credentials that they have going with Monolith and, you know, with the creator of Final Fantasy. But still... It's easy to say, well, NOA is, you know, being unreasonable or a bit, you know, they look bad because NOE's doing it. But, I mean, for just looking at it strictly from a commercial point of view, I do wonder why they're doing it.
Well, what I don't understand is so, okay, for a long time we've kind of wondered is, like, just how autonomous are NOA and NOE? Because I would expect that if Nintendo themselves did not want to release this in the West, you wouldn't see it showing up anywhere. But the fact that it's coming to Europe indicates that NOE is making the call to bring it out.
And it's interesting because, I mean, you think of Europe as being very weak in terms of a JRPG fan base, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because it lacks the heritage, you know, for the reasons that I described, you know, from the 16-bit era, where a lot of Nintendo fans got into JRPGs. It didn't happen in the same way because we didn't get Chrono Trigger. We didn't get Final Fantasy.
You got Terranigma.
I would also think that Europe would be much more fragmented than the U.S. in terms of being able to sell to a market. The U.S. is one huge market. North America is one massive market.
It's far more homogeneous.
Yeah, like I would think you would sell more in the U.S. by bringing it over. If you think these games aren't going to sell in the West, all right, I would think that if you're going to bring it out anywhere with that attitude, you would bring it out in the US as opposed to Europe.
I commend NOE for being willing to take a risk. I mean, that's the one thing, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
They're just less risk averse than Nintendo of America.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of this comes from Reggie. Reggie's a pretty hard bitten businessman.
Yeah.
And I think he's really kind of brought the axe down in a lot of ways. And now Nintendo of America has been, overall, I would say they've been more proactive about bringing Japanese games to the U.S.
With other people's Japanese games, you know, with the Dragon Quest situation. Sure.
If this was a Square game, we'd be getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that might be part of the story, is that, you know, what you've also got to look at is, you know, we've been talking about the sales potential in Europe and America, but what about what it has already sold in Japan? Now, obviously, Dragon Quest games have that you can hang on. Well, they were really popular in Japan. Maybe it's just waiting to break out. You know, Pokemon was really popular in Japan, and we eventually, you know, after like 3 years or whatever, they did bring it over, and it exploded too. So, you know, that gives you some faith that there's a kernel of something here that's like universal, and people will love it if they're exposed to it. Whereas Xenoblade, Last Story, they weren't bombs on the order of disaster by any means, but they didn't sell as much as something like Monster Hunter Tri, for instance, which Nintendo was also very proactive with helping. Yeah, that sold like about 1 million copies in Japan, yeah, more than their own biggest own games like Galaxy and stuff. So you could see why they would think that that has potential outside of Japan. Whereas, you know, I think where Reggie's sort of cold-blooded, kind of calculated nous might be coming into place. Well, look, if these didn't sell that well in Japan,
I think it just shows a lack of business creativity. And look, I'm in no position to question Reggie's business skills, because obviously he knows more about it than I do. But I think
he's the pizza master.
I ate a lot of Bigfoots, and
oh,
when I was a teenager, and actually played a lot of Final Fantasy III while eating Bigfoot pizzas. So anyway, I just feel like I think if Monster Hunter Tri was a modest success in America, then you could do the same thing with Xenoblade, because it's probably a better game and it's more accessible to a lot of people, I think. And this would be Nintendo publishing it, not just helping Capcom with marketing dollars. So they'd have more control over it. I think what it comes down to, quite frankly, is that people at Nintendo of America no longer understand how to sell these games. You know, and that's why you get Reggie in interviews saying, "I don't understand why Other M didn't sell." Well, that's because you don't understand that game. Mm-hmm. You really don't. And the people who used to understand those games and how to market them and how to build up hype for them and how to get people excited, how to explain these games to the consumer base, those people aren't at Nintendo anymore, as far as I can tell. Because Nintendo, this generation, Nintendo of America, has really lost the edge on how to sell those kind of games. We saw it with Corruption. We've seen it with Excite Truck. Excite Bots. We've seen it with a lot of stuff that Nintendo has put out this generation. They really seem at a loss on a lot of these more core games. Like, they've refocused themselves so much to the casual market, and they've been very good at that, but they've really sacrificed their expertise in what they used to do. And my issue with this is that, as I wrote this on Twitter, but if Nintendo is coming out at E3 and saying, "We really understand the hardcore gamer, we can satisfy you as well as people who don't play games as much or people who are newer to games. We can do both." Well, when I look at what they've done with the Wii, and I'm not just talking about Xenoblade and The Last Story and Pandora's Tower, this goes all the way back to the beginning. I don't see it. And what we're seeing now certainly doesn't look like they've had a change of heart. You can show me Metro Last Light trailers.
They're going to have to do some of the things they've talked about. You know, Iwata's talked about, well, we've had this problem with marketing and this. And it's like, well, yeah, sure.
Fix it.
But why wait until next year in a new system?
What they seem to be doing now, the American department seems to be saying, well, let's squarely put Wii in that, you know, it's cheap. The Walmart crowd, you know, it's that part of its life cycle now where people are picking, you know, it's picking it way later.
That's always been its life cycle from the beginning. That's
well,
how they
in
set
in
it
large
up.
Part, but now it seems like it's pretty difficult for them to kind of sell something that's outside of that particular milieu that we've got Mario Party again, and we've got the Dragon Quest Fortune Street board game, you know, coming, and you know, even Rhythm Heaven fits into that sort of a bit awkwardly, but they'll probably try and sell it that way.
You know, when Nintendo talks about like appealing to the hardcore, I kind of feel like there's somebody's dad who is trying to who was trying to be cool in front of his son's teenage buddies. If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's because like they talk about it, but then they just keep kind of stumbling over themselves. And the whole thing, I think it points to a bigger problem with Nintendo overall is that what they don't seem to understand is they kind of need to bring, I mean, you can't always look at everything from a strictly money standpoint of how much money a game is going to make in any particular area of the world. At some point, they have to extend an olive branch out to the quote-unquote hardcore, which, by the way, if you want to call them hardcore, these are the Nintendo hardcore that want these games. These are not hardcore gamers overall. These are people that love Nintendo, that buy Nintendo consoles, that are asking for these games, and Nintendo still turns their back on them.
I think the fact that, I mean, there's been letter writing campaigns online before, but there was one for Mother 3, which ultimately didn't really get anywhere.
There were potential legal issues with that game.
Yeah.
Well, I don't mean in terms of success. I mean in terms of how big the campaign got.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of energy devoted to online petitions for that game.
But no one really figured that game was ever going to come out of Japan anyways, right?
Yeah, the difference here is that these games are already out of Japan. There is a localization, an English one that exists that could be easily adapted, but same way the Exceed is doing it for Solitarobo. They're just co-opting a Nintendo of Europe, a localization. You know, that's happening.
Maybe that was their Xenoblade practice.
Well, but that's the question, isn't it? Because that was not Nintendo's game originally. You know, Nintendo of Europe sort of picked it up from Namco Bandai, then they kick it back to Exceed in America. You know, because this is originally, you know, an NCL game, would they be so cavalier, you know, and let another company handle it? They've done it in the past with like Cubivore, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. That was a long time ago.
But stuff like Fatal Frame, you know, Disaster in America, you know, it hasn't happened. There isn't precedent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you want to know how important this is to people, look at the talkback thread for the news story on our website. You've got diehard, lifelong Nintendo fans talking about boycotting the company. People are, and I'm not saying you should do that. That's a bad idea. It won't make any difference.
No.
But people are really pissed about this. It's bad for your consumer base to do this. I mean, the way Nintendo has handled it is very, very poor.
Yes,
you
very
can't just
poor.
Ignore this.
Well, and what I find more interesting about it is one of the things that this campaign encouraged people to do is to pre-order the game on Amazon, which for whatever reason, the Monado title was still fucking up there.
That's because the only title America's ever used.
No, but I mean, it was still listed. And it managed to shoot to the very top of the Amazon chart because people thought, okay, well, I'll vote with my dollars. That's how desperately people want a game.
Yeah, and that's what I don't understand because it hurts them both ways, right? I mean, let's say that they're playing it close to the vest and they're going to, you know, say a month from now, ooh, it's coming out. That's stupid.
Because you've already lost the momentum. I mean, if they had let this go for a couple more days instead of doing that weird Twitter/Facebook announcement of, hey, and they actually tweeted at the Twitter account of this campaign, hey, we appreciate your enthusiasm, but fuck you.
Yep.
I think the way they handled it wasn't great from the point of view that what they ultimately gave such a stock answer that what happened in between, you know, the 3 days when people were waiting for something. Originally, it was like, okay, you know, we recognize this. It's great to see, you know, people enthusiastic about this kind of stuff, and we're going to have an update for you. And then 3 days later, you get the stock answer that Johnny, you know, said. Yeah. It's just what you would always say. So why did that take any amount of time to reach that point? But furthermore, I mean, I think it's just a case they have decided, you know, that they're pretty much just not interested in, you know, trying to tend that particular revenue stream in North America at this point. You know, I mean, I think if you're not going to look at it purely from a sales point of view, just like, okay, the cost is this, the expected sales is this, are we up or down? You know, the other way of looking at it is diversification. You know, you need to try and tend multiple kinds of revenue streams in your software sales, because if one takes a hit, you don't want to get wiped out. So that is the commercial motive you could have for trying to sell some of these games that might not have hit written all over them. But clearly, while they say this is something they really want to do big time on Wii U, NOA's given up.
Right.
That's the, I mean, there's basically, NOA is willing to take a risk. They may end up taking a bath on it. anyway's given up on it. That's what it looks like.
Well, I don't...
I mean, because some people say, oh, well, maybe they're going to wait and see what the European sales are. I mean, maybe you could apply that with Xenoblade, but I mean, by the time something like Last Story is going to come out in 2012, by, you know, what it looks like is going to be the case there. By the time you've waited to see how much that's sold, the new console's going to be coming out. You got, you know, the time to release them is now. You know, the drought is now. I mean, yeah, there's
right.
no point
no
waiting
shit.
Until we're getting close to the Wii U coming out.
Unfortunately, my tweet got chopped by our Twitter program because we have a much lower maximum character because we have to get the URL in. But my tweet ended up when I wrote the article about the announcement with a callback to the Op Rainfall Twitter account and then a follow-up hashtag of Op Drought, which just got truncated to the hashtag sign. But honestly, what's really amusing about this is if you go – I mean, this was a totally social networking-driven thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the social networks, and it's just like our forums, but even some cases worse. I mean, these are people who were like, I'm so mad I can't begin to vocalize it.
Well, I think that it is because you have got an English language that exists. You know, it's like you,
right.
The cost must be so kind of negligible that not negligible. That's the wrong word. But you know, they must be so slight that
in comparison, exactly, to bringing other games over from Japan.
What I don't understand is if Nintendo of Europe is willing to start, I don't want to say pulling their weight, but contributing to this effort. Why aren't the two sides just divvying up the work then?
Share the risk.
Well, clearly they don't need to share it because Europe's going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
I have a few thoughts on this. I mean, first off, Neil, and I'm not calling Neil an apologist, but the apologist angle on this, and Neil mentioned something about this on Twitter as well. He says, look, I'm upset about this, but let's just be honest. If Nintendo of America did release these games, they wouldn't sell. And my response to that is, whose fault is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a hole that Nintendo of America dug for themselves, and they're not making any effort to climb back out of it.
Yeah.
And that's the disturbing thing to me is because with the new system, let's make this clear. With the Wii U, the hardcore gamer that they're supposedly going to try to aim for, most of them already own a Wii.
Yes.
So if you want to tell somebody, you need to buy our new system, because we're going to make it worth your while, you could certainly start now.
Yeah.
There's the potential is there. And that is Nintendo's responsibility and prerogative to actually take the reins and say, you know what? We can sell a game to these core gamers. They've already got the hardware.
Yep.
It's not that hard to do. It's a perception problem, and they cannot change the perception.
Nintendo is acting like there aren't core gamers that have Wiis right now.
No, you know who they're acting like?
Which amazes me.
They're acting like the third parties who complained that people didn't buy their games that came in the middle and end of the Wii's life cycle when they put out shit at the start of the Wii's life cycle.
Yeah.
You ended up with a situation where I'm not going to buy any Ubisoft games because they put out 8 Wii launch games and they all sucked.
Yep.
Why should I believe that any game they put out isn't going to suck?
Look, Nintendo has burned a lot of core gamers on the Wii. There are a lot of people who bought a Wii and are not happy that they did.
Mm-hmm.
Because they, I mean, Chris Kohler actively solicited photos on social networks this week of Wii controllers with layers of dust on them.
You know, it's not just that. He's actually going to run an article on Wired on
right.
Friday with pictures of games of people's Wii controllers or stories about how their Wii is not being used.
Yeah.
Those are people who made a significant investment, probably on the order of $250, $350, to buy a Wii expecting to play games on it, and now are very bitter about that decision. And those people, you have a very, very long hill to climb to get them to buy a Wii U.
Yep.
You're going to have to bend over backwards to prove to them that it's not going to happen again. And Nintendo's current behavior is doing quite the opposite.
I think when you trace it all the way back, though, what you've got is a real timing problem from the point of view that, you know, these games could have made, I think, a lot more impact in Japan if they were released earlier in the life cycle. You know, if Monolith weren't pissing about with disaster and you had something like Xenoblade coming out years earlier when the Wii was at its sort of apex of adoption rate coming on, you know, then I think it could have made more of an impact in Japan, and then they'd think more favorably about releasing it in America off the back of that.
Yeah, but But Greg, I mean, Gears of War 3 is going to sell just fine this holiday season, and Xbox 360 is a six-year-old console. The problem is there's a gap in the middle.
But you already had built up people's expectations to expect that kind of game with two fucking games in the same franchise.
Exactly. The problem is there's a vacuum. Mm-hmm. The problem is not that Xenoblade came out late in the life cycle. It's that nothing came out before it.
Exactly. That's my point. If you had
that's what
them,
he's saying.
If you had them earlier on in the life cycle.
Or games like them, not necessarily them.
Yeah, not necessarily them specifically, but the point is they seem to recognize at some point that we need games like this on the system, and you know, they tasked Monolith, a company that they bought, with doing one of them, and then obviously they made The Last Story happen as well, but it was years too late.
Sure.
And then, you know, it becomes a tricky proposition for people at NOA off the back of that, too, because they can't look at something and say, well, it did well in Japan, at least we could say that.
I mean, I own a great deal of Wii games. I can't claim to own a great deal of Wii games like these because they simply aren't there. They just don't exist.
And the other problem is that if you were hoping like for Dragon Quest to do it or whatever, I mean, that always comes out at the end. Like, you know, you're not
right.
going to have
yeah.
Dragon Quest X come out 2 years ago and get everyone on board, and then Xenoblade comes out after it and mops up.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the other things that this kind of underscored for me is the fact that Nintendo really is poor at talking to its fan base in a personalized way.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, you've brought this up before, John, about like how the other companies have their blogs and their faces. They've got their Major Nelsons.
Yeah.
And their...
I mean, their Twitter account is so poor. It's like something straight out of a like marketing brochure on that Twitter account. And furthermore, there's no blog. The problem is right now is that when something happens that people are pissed off about, they want answers. And they want it directly
right.
from the company, and they want it in a way where it doesn't sound like it's just coming from some corporate robot.
They want the Capcom Unity effect.
Yeah, and I mean, this goes across everything. I mean, the whole, just that whole cheesy Twitter account and the Iwata asks that come down from on high when someone decides to, you know, step off their cloud and speak to the unwashed masses.
Yeah, and I mean, notice how they've drastically cut down on press access to their developers since they started putting out these Iwata asks interviews. It's like,
oh yeah,
well, we don't need Nintendo World Report to interview these developers, because we'll just do it ourselves.
Yeah.
And people don't like that, because they're not going to ask each other the hard questions.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot. No. It's very... I wouldn't say it's very Japanese, because Sony is obviously Japanese, and they are much better in this department, but they remind me... Nintendo reminds me of Square Enix. That's who they remind me of, because Square Enix is very much like that. And they had the same kind of thing where they actually, for Final Fantasy XIV... when it started to shit the bed and people were like, what the hell is up with this game that I paid for? It sucks. They actually did get a blog with an official community manager to manage that. And they said that that's one of the things that they wanted to do was communicate with their fan base better. And they said that in Japan, there's very much an attitude where, look, you just play our games, enjoy them, and we don't want your input.
Well, that's an unflattering comparison, because Square Enix is not a very beloved company right now.
Exactly.
They've lost a ton of goodwill, and not just from FF14, but from the past 5 years at least.
Yep.
Because they haven't communicated, and in fact, they've almost completely lost an understanding of their fans and what they want.
Yep.
So, yeah, in conclusion, we're pissed too, and it's a bad situation. And one thing I do want to say, in the interest of optimism, it's not too late for Nintendo of America to fix this. It's really never too late until, you know, 2 years from now when these games are old and nobody cares anymore. But right now, there's still plenty of time for them to reverse course on this. And, you know, I think the Operation Rainfall, the letter writing campaign, as I said in our talkback thread, letter writing campaigns are pretty much the only effective social action to leverage on corporations over the past few decades. Boycotts don't work unless you get at least half the audience to boycott, and that's never going to happen in this situation. And online petitions are complete BS, so writing a personal letter to the company and explaining how you feel about it, if they get a sizable volume of those, personalized letters are taken seriously. It's an old-fashioned thing, but they do still carry some weight. So if you really care about it, that is the correct response, and I would encourage you to go and get involved with it.
Yeah.
All right, so now we're going to get to our listener mail, finally, and James has the first letter.
Thomas, a.k.a. Killer Manjaro, writes, quick question, somewhat random. What is the reason behind Johnny's obsession with jetpacks and grappling hooks in video games? There are certain things that I like to look for in games, but something as specific as those two is quite odd, especially if you were to purchase a game based solely on the fact that it features these items. After all, the Rush Jet adapter does not make Mega Man 6 a better game. So, if you wouldn't mind, I'd be interested to hear the roots of this fascination.
Yes, it does. And
no, it doesn't.
I would also include web swinging into this, and I usually don't bring that up because...
That's awfully specific.
Exactly, because, well, it's similar to grappling. It is kind of like a grappling hook, actually. So maybe that's maybe it's just a subset of that. So I think I can explain it very easily. I like exploring in games. I like games that feature novel methods of transportation. In 2D games, that was usually accomplished by something like this. So the difference between these and, let's say, like being able to just fly anywhere you want to all the time is that that has no limits, so it's hard to design levels around that. Whereas these items like jetpacks, which probably have a limited use, hopefully, as in Mega Man 6, one reason I really like that one is that the meter fills up as soon as you touch the ground. So it's not like you have to store up energy and then you have to be careful, you have to be judicious about when you use it because you don't know when you're going to get more energy for it. That sucks a lot of the fun out of a mechanic like that. Instead, it's, I've got this number of seconds, can I be skillful enough to actually get where I want to go before it runs out? With grappling hooks, it makes you completely reanalyze the environment and how you interact with it. Because now, instead of just standing on something and being able to jump, now you look at the ceiling, you look at the walls, you look at the ledges, and how do I chain these together? It's the Bionic Commando effect. I mean, it's why Bionic Commando is amazing. It's why you can't jump in Bionic Commando, because they want to force you to look at these levels in a completely different way than you do in other games, and it's the magic of that game. So that's why I like it, because in a 2D side-scrolling, in other words, in the games that I grew up with, in a 2D paradigm, jetpacks and grappling hooks are the primary ways that you shake up the basic Super Mario Brothers platforming gameplay.
Yeah. I mean, I think, obviously, you know, it's the design as well. I mean, it's not just the presence of the item.
Well, no, the game has to be designed around them, of course.
Yeah, exactly. So
the flying hat in Mario 64 is not always well executed.
Yeah, I mean, no, I think where I tend to like this kind of thing the most is where it's a power-up, where you've got a level that you have traversed one way, and then you get a power up that radically changes how you can traverse it and makes it sort of easier, but it still mm-hmm. works within that. You could see that layout was purposefully designed to be done in both ways. You know, and so that's a big theme in obviously the Metroid series. Yeah. You know, that backwards and forwards level design, and because it feels empowering. You know, you did it one way a bunch of times and now you have this and you're doing the same thing in a different way and it feels different. It feels faster. It feels easier. You feel more powerful. So I'm not so big on something like, you know, I mean, Bionic Commando is a really good game. I really like that. But, you know, that is the whole game. There's no kind of feeling of I am more powerful now so much with that, because, you know, at the fundamental level, it's always using the grappling hook, which is still
not.
Yeah,
but if you just, you have to zoom out a little bit and look at all the other games that this would be extremely similar to, except for this twist that makes it so fresh.
Where that's, exactly, that's where that's nice, is there's a change of pace on the macro level.
John, James?
I remember, I guess it was E3 09, Johnny and I were in Capcom's booth, and Dark Void was there, and his eyes lit up.
Yes.
Because it was a game about jetpacks. And he was just gone.
I think I played that demo twice, and I was really crushed when the game didn't turn out well in the end. Because that's the thing, I mean, you can put these awesome mechanics in it, but if the game itself isn't designed well around them, and if the game isn't good, then I'm not going to play it just because it has a jetpack in it. It has to be a good game. So I get excited when I see a game that I already expect to be good, and I found out that they added a grappling hook to it. I'm like, oh, shit, son. Because that's the real magic formula.
So basically what we're saying is that you and Thomas have a difference of opinion about Mega Man 6. I think that's pretty much it.
I guess so, yeah, because I already love the Mega Man games, and then they added a really well-implemented jetpack to Mega Man 6, and it just took that game to a new level for me. It's not my favorite Mega Man game, but I think it's much better than 5, and it's much better than 7, primarily because of the jetpack. Because it really changes the way you play that game. Which, well, it changes the way I play it, at least.
to me, that was never like my be-all, end-all Mega Man. I preferred some of the earlier ones. So to me, there's like, okay, well, they had to add something, and they went with jetpacks. They didn't fuck it up, so I'll give them credit for that.
High praise from James Jones.
My relationship with Capcom is kind of like an abusive one, where it's like, hey, we have this game, you're not going to like it, but you're going to buy it anyway, aren't you? I'm like, yeah, just give it to me.
I mean, look at what they added in Mega Man 5. They added a bird that drops off items or that runs around and kills things. So it doesn't really change the way you play the game. And Mega Man is a game about running, jumping, and shooting. So you add a jetpack to it, and you have fundamentally changed the way that you play that game. And also, it's a jetpack with really no drawbacks. I mean, it doesn't make your gun weaker. You can't use other special weapons, but once you get it, there's very little reason to use the normal blue Mega Man profile, because now you can do all the same stuff and fly.
I was ready to move on from Mega Man at that point, which is why I bought Mega Man X, because I moved on.
All right, John has the next email.
Panderadox writes, I know a lot of people are criticizing Nintendo's announcement of various third-party games, such as Assassin's Creed, Ghost Recon, Metro, Batman, etc., on Wii U that are coming out this fall on other consoles. While this isn't to say that games that launch closer to Wii U launch will also come out for Wii U, do you think expectations of Wii U with these games is particularly high? I think the pressure for Nintendo to revitalize sales of these games with a fresh Wii U take on them is uniquely high. If these late versions of the games don't deliver, it could tarnish expectations of a new system. With that being said, a stellar performance by any of these Wii U versions might not be necessary as long as Nintendo can just prove that Wii U can keep up with 360 and PS3. It could be a win-win for Nintendo. Your thoughts?
This happens a lot, though, when you have these skewed releases. So you have a system in the next generation come out 1 year and then the other one come out the next. A lot of times you'll get the same game 6, 7, 8 months later on the second system to come out as a launch title. Mm-hmm. You saw it a lot when the PS3 came out. It got some 360 games that had been out for as much as 6 or 7 months. Mm-hmm. You see it a lot with like the Madden games too, where the next gen system comes out at exactly the wrong time for a Madden game. So they end up getting like this really busted ass Madden game 1 year and then getting the next year's like 3 months later that's not quite so utterly broken and janked out.
Yeah.
But I mean, this happens a lot, and third parties are very aware of this. They're used to it. I mean, this happens every console generation.
And they love it because it's a way for them to amortize the cost that they've already spent developing these games for the other platforms.
Yep.
Yeah, and I mean, if it is as easy to port from, you know, especially 360
yeah.
to Wii U, if the costs and effort involved are that slight, then, you know, the bar for what they have to sell purely from that, you know, economic perspective, it may be quite low. So, you know, they could still feel pretty confident. Well, we put out a version. It's this many months later. It's probably not going to do great business, but we're going to make money on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would do it. And then I guess the problem would come in, you know, if we tried to do something more ambitious, more Wii U specific, could we justify the cost of that with the returns that we'd get? You know, they kind of have to maybe feel their way out to that over time.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about Wii U is that it will be the most powerful system when it's launched. So Nintendo hasn't been in that situation in a very long time. And I think, you know, when you saw stuff like Gun being released as an Xbox 360 launch title, that suffered from a really poor, almost actually really lazy kind of HD up-resing.
It was kind of a comedic port because it not only did it kind of screw up the gameplay, they went and they did this like, how much effort will it take to make this come out in 720p, even if it's just up-resed? Now take that amount of effort and cut it in half. Make that game.
Right. Yeah, so it's not going to be that bad because these games are coming from, they're already HD, they won't have to redo assets. So the question is, how much of a bump can we expect to see in these third-party games that in Arkham City, how much better is Arkham City going to look on Wii U than it does on 360? Well, it's directly proportional to the amount of effort that company puts into the Wii U version, and
right.
and the level of effort is probably based on how many they think they can sell to people who haven't already bought it on the other systems, which I don't think will be that high.
No, and I think it's difficult for a system like Wii U because it's kind of coming out at a strange time. And to be honest, it's going to factor in a bit what the lineup looks like in the very near future, too, for that system. I mean, if they see that there's a bunch of shit coming out in that second wave, they might want to put it out quickly because it might not have as long a shelf life.
Well, and also, I mean, you know, how much pressure they would feel, you know, purely on the visual side. You know, I mean, you've got to think to yourself, Nintendo's obviously going to be publishing Wii U games at launch that you're kind of going up against.
Steel Diver HD.
They won't have anything like Metro Last Light, I can tell you that.
Well, yeah, that's true. But, I mean, just purely from a kind of dollars point of view. But, I mean, the point is that is Nintendo going to come out straight away with HD games that can challenge, you know, not because the system isn't powerful enough, but just because, you know, from them as a company, you know, their experience or lack thereof of developing HD stuff, you know, are they really going to come out with things that look better than Arkham City at launch? Or, you know, I mean,
no.
So why would they feel any pressure to upgrade the graphics, even though the capacity is there?
Right.
It's basically going to be exactly the same. Maybe it can help with performance in certain areas. So, you know, maybe we might get a bit less screen tearing.
Better frame rate.
More stable frame rate, things like that. Yeah. That would be nice. But, you know, really, you know, tangible aesthetic improvements, I think, are off the table. And the question is whether you would have meaningful, you know, integration with the controller, you know, so something like with Batman, you know, you'd have the detective mode is a delegated to the controller and things like that. You know, SIG's actually made an interface improvement.
There is a chance for the Wii U versions to be the sort of definitive seminal versions of some of these games.
Well, you could probably tack on some DLC that already came out, you know, the Game of the Year edition stuff.
Right. Yeah. But like, how marginal is that?
Yeah, I mean, we already know that the Ninja Gaiden game is getting its own subtitled version.
But they, I mean, in interviews, they're kind of talking about having control options that are akin to Dragon Sword on DS.
Yeah.
I mean, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's a lot more fundamental than I would expect anything like Darksiders and Batman to change.
Right. Yeah, that's taking the big risk pill, not the little risk pill.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing, we haven't talked about this very much yet, but the question of, like, how much more powerful is Wii U than the current systems, it might be a moot point for some of these games if they're doing a lot with the controller screen, because that is a secondary display, and the console has to produce the graphics for that controller as well, plus do all the interface back and forth stuff over the wireless connection, some of which is probably significant. So remember in the early days of the Wii when we had the reports that said, well, Wii is 2 to 3 times more powerful than GameCube. That's true. On a purely specification level, the Wii is 2 to 3 times more powerful than the GameCube. But by the time you have it, do all the data filtering for the motion controls and do widescreen and all the other stuff that Wii does that GameCube didn't really do for the most part, the actual usable margin of performance is very small. And as we've seen over the years, it takes a lot of effort from the developer to really squeeze out that extra performance margin and turn it into something that looks different on the screen. Very few Wii games look like something that could not have been done on the GameCube, even though the system is significantly more powerful, let's say. It's not a generational leap ahead, but it is significantly more powerful. I think with Wii U, that's even more of a concern because it's computing this entirely separate display and beaming it out to this crazy controller. That's going to take up a significant percentage of what the system's capable of doing, and whatever it uses to do that, that's performance that you cannot use to make the games look better.
That second screen is a relatively lower resolution, though, which does diminish its
processor intensiveness. You know. I mean, anybody who's looking at the Wii U market as a, you know, prospective market, I don't think they're going to be thinking the techno supremacists live there. So it will be based around making the interface cleaner or enhanced with the controller rather than making the game look better. It's just, I just don't think they're going to put that level of effort into that at all. And as I said, I don't think they're going to have very much to worry about in terms of looking inferior, because Nintendo may push the system to its limits, but they could well take a while to get there because, as we said, they're not experienced in the HD development realm. Mm-hmm. And also, they tend to make things with such a different kind of aesthetic, you know, more colourful, cartoony, you know, that even if we did have something, you know, a Mario game that was, in percentage terms, using much more of the Wii U's potential, you know, you wouldn't look at then go back to Arkham City and go, oh, well, now, you know, I can't even look at this anymore because that Mario game is so beautiful. You know, it's just not going to work that way. So it would be
substantially later into the Wii U's life, probably, where they might have to think about making the graphics look substantially better. And then we may well be talking about, you know, the next Microsoft console by that time. Mm-hmm. So, right. So that's a whole other can of worms.
As soon as this Kinect bump wears off, Microsoft will start talking about that stuff. But that could be a couple of years. That could be a couple of years.
Yeah.
So
I'd expect a couple of years.
Just as an aside, when I was at home, I actually ended up buying a Wii for my parents because I'd missed a few holidays, and I figured I'd just lump them together and buy something big for them, and my mom had been wanting one for a while for some reason. So I went into a GameStop, which I'm loath to ever do, and I went in there, and since I was there, I would take the pulse of the little people.
The field work.
This is my hometown GameStop.
J. Edgar Hoover working the beat.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. I went undercover, find out what's happening on the streets of America. And so I asked him, so how's the 3DS been doing? You know, and I figure, well, if it sells here, then it's doing pretty well in my little hometown. And he said, it's been pretty much a bomb worldwide. And I said, well, you know, they've sold 4 or 5 million units. But yeah, it's not been doing gangbusters or anything. And he said, well, I mean, just to give you an example, like, you know, Ocarina of Time came out about a week earlier. He said, we had 8 people come in on launch day and pick up the game. Some of them were pre-orders. Some of them were just walk-ins. And we haven't sold a copy since.
What?
Wow.
And I think that fit in line with my expectations, actually, which is I think a lot of people have been waiting for this game. But this game is not going to sell. It's not going to be on the NPD charts for the rest of the year. It'll get a bump around Christmas because they'll remarket it.
Yeah.
It may end up being the best-selling 3DS game, but it's not a system seller.
And also, it's gonna turn them a tidy profit. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it's going to sell, it's going to be
from a business standpoint. It's very
but
shrewd.
I mean, you are waiting until Christmas for this stuff. I mean, that is how, well, Mario Kart might be a little bit before that. Super Mario, you know, assuming they stick to what they've said and it doesn't get delayed. But that's how long it
gets. But it will.
Wait.
Super Mario will get delayed.
Yeah. Kid Icarus is not going to, you know, set the world alight, however good the game is. I don't know how good it's going to be.
Which is not very good.
Yeah.
One thing about Kid Icarus that I thought was absolutely perplexing is no one talked about the single player game at E3. No one. It was on demo, apparently. According to Aaron, they had the single player, they had the multiplayer, they had the AR stuff.
I think it might have been the GDC demo, and maybe
I guess it would have had to be exactly the same, but isn't that in itself a little bit disturbing that they couldn't update?
Maybe nobody wanted to play it, because we've played it before and it was bad.
Here's why people didn't talk about that demo that much. There's a couple big reasons, but one of the least immediately apparent reasons is they had an equal number of demo units for the stupid AR cards, which was the dumbest demo in that stupid booth, and the single player. And then they had a whole bunch for the multiplayer. And multiplayer was what was new for us, unless you count AR cards. But those two lines moved very fast. The single player line moved very slow. And ultimately, they just said Kid Icarus, Kid Icarus, Kid Icarus over them. Didn't say Kid Icarus single, didn't say Kid Icarus stupid AR card thing, stay away, your brain will melt, and Kid Icarus multi. So he said, well, that line's empty, that line's empty, that line's long, this one. And then you got the AR card demo, and you switched over and played the multiplayer game, and you're like,
I've had enough Kid Icarus.
Yeah. I mean, having 3 demos there was dumb. They should have had the multiplayer demo and just called it that.
Well, they may as well have done on the basis of the coverage that it got.
Yep.
I do think the single player demo from just over the shoulder stuff I did looked very similar.
Which is to say that it's not very good. I heard scathing reports on the multiplayer too.
The multiplayer is just, it's whacked.
Enough with the pylon.
Yes. So, Jeff from Vancouver writes, personally, I'm super happy about the next Nintendo console. The new controller looks intriguing, and to have a next-gen level of graphics and performance for first-party Nintendo titles will be great. However, like Johnny mentioned a while ago, I'm also ready for Nintendo to produce a classic-style, fully wireless controller. Whether it be to play the next 3D Mario game or a third-party multi-platform game and have a similar experience to the 360 and PS3, I would love for Nintendo to finally allow everyone to choose their own play style, motion controls or touchscreen controls or classic controls, at least in some instances. I'm looking at you, DKC.
Is this wishful thinking? It shouldn't be outside of the realm of possibility for them to make a Bluetooth classic controller and provide firmware update. After all, Nintendo's presumed built-in consumer base already has multiple Wii controllers, and as far as we know, the new system will only have the one Wii U controller sold with it. Somehow, they have to get themselves back into the controller selling business, right?
Yeah, that would be a way to do it, is just to have, you know, a classic controller that's completely independent of the Wii Remote. I mean, you know, as we know, they're being gracious enough to let us use the Wii Remote and all that, so certainly you'd expect that a lot of people are still going to use their current Pros, you know, that they like those, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they did the Pro. I mean, that's completely unnecessary. I like it a lot. I think it's an improvement, but, you know, it was just, here's a better version so we could sell some more controllers. Why wouldn't you just do that again, with the thing being that this time it's just completely wireless?
I think they might also go for a wireless nunchuck. I think the technology has probably improved to the point where that's something they're going to be looking at. I mean, Jeff has an excellent point. The funny thing about the new system coming with the one controller and that's all it supports is that it kills their accessories market, which has been lucrative as shit on the Wii.
That is something that they've been, you know, leaning on a lot. Yeah. So to get to a point where, you know, that is like threatened at a fundamental level, yes, they are going to take measures to make sure they're still going to be selling stuff.
Yeah.
And not just that Zapper thing with the huge map thing.
I don't think they're going to sell that many of the funky tablet Zapper.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you could pretty much bank on that kind of stuff. You know, that they'll find ways to sell us new things, and you know, I mean, I it's never been something that's really bothered me that much. The whole like having to plug it in thing, especially since they put the cord in at the top rather than that. They bothered me with the original classic controller with the cord coming at the bottom. That was just
weird. They went straight Dreamcast.
Yeah.
By the way, Dreamcast controller sucks.
Hey, look, it's got finger puppet theater. That's all it needs.
Yeah. I kind of like it. I like it because it's so strange.
But Jeff is definitely on the right track, and maybe this is a good chance for our listeners to start brainstorming new accessories that Nintendo could sell for the Wii U, because...
Don't do that. Don't give them ideas, please.
No, you should. Let us know what you think of, because, he's right. Like, we already own or will be packed in all the controllers that you need to play this thing. So they're going to have to figure out some way. I mean, I wonder if they're going to do like maybe an upgraded Wii Remote Plus that has a built-in rechargeable battery and stuff like that. You know, maybe that has the support for has like the built-in support for the wireless nunchuck, so you don't have to clip a dongle onto it.
Yeah.
I could see there's a number of ways in which you can improve. You could upgrade the speaker, which would, you know, and make it backwards compatible with all the Wii games. But for Wii U games, you could have them take advantage of the better speaker.
Wii Remote Pro, it's going to happen.
Hey, there you go.
Oh, boy.
There you go. All right, and Greg has the last letter.
Tim from Pennsylvania writes, I wanted to ask about the crew's opinions on two non-Nintendo games. The first is Infamous. I have not heard your opinions on this game. The most I ever remember hearing of it on the show was a brief mention in passing. Is it simply that none of you have played it? I would really love to hear opinions on this game from people with tastes similar to mine. I, for one, loved it and would recommend it strongly if you've not given it a try yet. Secondly, I would like to know how you all feel about the Metal Gear Solid series. In the history of the show, there have been many times in which Johnny or James would groan at the mention of the series or crack a joke about Kojima's lack of competence as a game director. This strikes me as odd, considering the considerable acclaim the series has received and the large, rabid fan base it has obtained. Do you genuinely not like these games and Kojima, or are you merely poking fun at them?
Well, let's start with Infamous. James, I assume you haven't played it.
I love a PS3, so yeah,
I own Infamous. And I have played it.
Oh,
I have to specify that, as sad as that is. But yeah, I actually played. I haven't beaten it, but I have actually played pretty deeply into it. And yeah, it's really good. Infamous is a really good game. I don't have like an opinion of the game as a whole because obviously I haven't played all the way through to the end. Kind of my complaints about it is that it does get a little bit repetitive, because I mean you're effectively just. It's sort of Crackdown-ish in the way that you can, you know, jump really high, get superpowers, do all kinds of crazy shit, but you're effectively just going from one spot on the map to this other spot on the map, and you have to, you know, kill somebody or something like that.
You take a mission.
Yeah.
more so than in Crackdown. Crackdown's all assassinations and in Infamous, it's more, you get these kind of GTA style missions where you have to defend something or you have to escort someone or
fly the RC airplane.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's weird stuff. Sometimes it's a race.
Yeah.
So I did own Infamous. It was actually the first game I bought with my PS3 2 years ago. And that would have been the last time I talked about it in depth, but I did talk about it on the show. So if you want to go back, you can get the full rundown there. But I liked Infamous and I beat it. Basically, I agree with John. I mean, for me, it was kind of like the PlayStation's version of Crackdown, which I love Crackdown. So mm-hmm. it was good for me. There's certain things I like more in Infamous and certain things I like less. In some ways, it reminds me of like Spider-Man 2, the GameCube game that was really good. It was kind of the first open world comic book game. And Infamous, I think, is a descendant of that, as is Crackdown. As is Prototype, for that matter. And, you know, now that Infamous 2 is out, I'm looking forward to playing that. I'm probably going to rent it because mm-hmm. I actually ended up selling back. I traded in the first Infamous because I felt like it was a game that I would probably never go back to.
Yeah.
You could go back and play it as Evil, you know?
Yeah.
But I found that the game was more than long enough the first time.
So basically, what I've read about 2 is that it's basically a sequel. Like, I mean, it is a sequel, but I mean, it's this game with new levels.
Yeah, but it's been 2 years, so that's fine. And maybe I'll go Evil this time, so I get a little bit different perspective on it when I do play Infamous 2. But I'm looking forward to it. You know, I'm not a huge fan of Sucker Punch. I don't really care for the Sly Cooper games. So there's some crossover with Infamous in the way that the character moves. One thing I really like is that the game is very vertical.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that the character has a lot of cool mobility tools. I mean, this goes back to the first email. You know, I really like how you can hold out your hands and use it to kind of hover. And I like how you can latch onto power lines and grind them like rails in a Tony Hawk game and go really fast on them.
Yep.
That stuff is really fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that a lot of the game is about kind of moving up and down buildings. And I found that process to be very tedious.
Yeah.
And after a while, it really kind of... I really got tired of having to go up and down. It's like once I got on top of the buildings, if I could stay up there, then I had a good time racing back and forth across the city. But if I ever got knocked down or if I ever had to go down to ground level, I got kind of annoyed at it because he runs very slowly. And so if you're not up there grinding on power cables, it actually takes a very long time to get around.
Yeah.
And I just got, it wore down on me after a while.
Yeah. It seems like once you get up on top, you can move around very quickly and you get like a better sense of almost power or kind of scale. And then, but if you fall off down to the ground, you're just like this little dink, 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 little guy running around again, you know, and you feel like you can't get anywhere quickly.
There's a lot less interaction with the environment when you're on the ground because
a
lot of his powers revolve around using the things that are higher up in the environment. But hey, it's worth playing for sure.
It's a good game.
If you haven't cashed in your PSN Welcome Back credits yet, you can download the entire game for free. So give it a shot. You got nothing to lose there. So Metal Gear Solid. Now, James has certainly played this series.
So in my defense of making fun of Kojima, first, he deserves it. But secondly, his own English language Twitter account description is game designer, : 70% of my body is made of movies. So at least he acknowledges what we make fun of him for, which is that he puts a lot of freaking movies in his games and that his stories are completely insane.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, we bag on that series because it takes itself so damn seriously.
Even if he doesn't seem to.
And it's so absurd.
Yeah.
There is an evil organization that I believe is called the Lolly Lule Low. Fuck me. What is that?
And they run the Patriots, which is also an acronym.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like... I mean...
Like, yeah. I mean, if you look at any of the timelines, like... It's just crazy.
I mean, I like the Metal Gear Solid series. I think any making fun of Kojima that you might have heard from me was exaggerated. I actually really love the Zone of the Enders games. And I wish that he would make more of those, because I think in terms of the way they play, those are way more up my alley. Those are fast character action games where you fly in a mech. Those are super fun. And I also like the Boktai series, which Kojima Productions did, which is more of a kind of a Zelda-style thing, like James talked about with Lunar Knights.
That's probably what brought this email on, is the Lunar Knights conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm excited to get to play Zone of the Enders. I didn't get to play it when it came out originally. So
Yeah, because they're bringing it to Xbox now.
Yeah, so I'm excited for the chance to play those games.
Oh, you're going to love it, James.
I had always wanted to play those games. I mean...
And by the way, the story is completely ridiculous in Zone of the Enders as well. But it's right up your alley. It's basically like the Innocent Aces Skycrawler story. It's almost the same story.
I enjoy that kind of ridiculousness story, not because it's like, wow, this is a deep shit story. It's like, because damn, this shit is crazy. What next crazy thing are they going to do?
They're
going to
stick a 10-year-old into a mech and he has to save the world. That's what they're going to do. And also he's going to talk about his soul a lot.
That's not really all that crazy, to be honest. In the grand scheme of things, that's like talking to your cats and expecting a response crazy. That's not thinking your cats is the King of England crazy. Like, there's a bridge that hasn't been crossed yet on the crazy scale. And you're still on the near bank. You haven't gone... over there.
Now, in terms of the actual Metal Gear series...
If that mech actually starts to talk to the 10-year-old, you've now crossed the bridge.
Of course it does. It has an AI.
No. It has to actually have, like, a mouth that moves and...
No. Doesn't
okay, we haven't crossed the bridge yet. An AI I'm willing to tolerate. I draw a line. If it's artificial intelligence, that's okay. If it's magic, that's a problem.
Yeah, so as for the actual Metal Gear Solid series, for me, it's like moments of brilliant gameplay, a lot of bullshit gameplay too, and then the cutscenes.
Well, the thing is, the first game, when I played it, it pretty much blew my mind. So good for its time period. I thought the enemies were pretty nutso, which obviously carried on through the rest of the series, but that's a really, really good game. The second game kind of lost me. The third game, I didn't really play either.
It's too bad. The third game is a big improvement over the second one and the first one. The third game is my favorite by far.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It's like I haven't played the second or the third, but I did play Metal Gear Solid 4. All the way through. Mm-hmm. That game is a freaking movie fest and really is, I don't know how 3 was, but 4, the movies in that game, they are insane. They're so freaking long.
It's like a self-parody.
It really is.
It's like Kojima said, everybody makes fun of me for putting too many cutscenes in my games, so I'm just going to double the percentage of cutscenes in this
like,
one.
Yeah, there's cutscenes in that game that are like 25 minutes long.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
That is not an exaggeration.
Yeah,
at all.
Not even exaggerating.
Put down the controller and go make a sandwich.
Yeah.
The series is very self-aware at this point. I mean, even if you go like back to 3, the original trailer for that game was just Snake running around in camo with a dead alligator's head on his head. Not doing anything, just running the fuck around with this thing on his head. That was the trailer for the game. That's how they chose to show it.
See, I think the sad thing about the Metal Gear Solid series is that what made it interesting in the first place was the stealth gameplay.
Yeah.
And it hasn't aged that well. If you go back to 1998's Metal Gear Solid, that game hasn't aged very well.
No.
But then they remade it 5 years later, and the Twin Snakes, I think, has aged pretty well. And I know a lot of the series purists like to shit on the Twin Snakes. But if you've never played Metal Gear Solid, start there. Trust me.
That's how I got into the series. I played the Twin Snakes.
Because, you'll think the cutscenes are really crazy, but then by the time you get to 4, they got nothing on what happens in 4.
He jumped on atop of a missile and ran over it. That's fucking crazy.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that the first game now, I mean, the 3D engine it runs on looks absolutely terrible. It just does. Yeah.
I think the first Metal Gear Solid's kind of unplayable at this point.
Yeah, it's...
Hey, it's on PSN if you want to try it for like $8 or whatever, but it's not going to hold up very well at all.
No.
Go get the Twin Snakes. It looks good. It plays well.
I don't think we have anything against Kojima personally. I mean...
No, absolutely not.
He's not making Z games. He's making games... I don't want to use the word auteur, but he's kind of like what that industry has in that term. He makes things for him.
Yeah.
He makes whatever he wants to make.
He doesn't listen to, I mean, for God's sakes, Metal Gear Rising has been out in this, like, no man's land where the only way we get to see it is cutting watermelons. Mm-hmm. Why? Because that's what he wants to do. I want to make a game where you can precision cut a watermelon.
I think Rising has the potential to be my favorite game in the series. I think it looks more like an actual game
from everything that they've shown of it. But at the same time, it's been so long since they showed anything substantial that it could have been completely redone at this point.
It's been, it's
soliloquies.
Yeah.
All soliloquies.
Occasionally you cut the screen to go to the next one.
Yeah, that's the thing about Metal Gear. It's not just the cut scenes, it's the damn codec scenes where it's just talking heads.
Yeah.
That is literally, it's talking heads. And this can go on for 15, 20 minutes. And it's very frequent. And it just happens in the middle of gameplay. You shoot a dude, they have a long conversation about it.
It won't even mean anything, though. Snake,
no.
I watched this film the other day.
Really? Snake turned into Christian Bale's Batman.
Absolutely. I mean, and you'll just be sitting there and you'll be like, what? Like, I mean, and this is in the middle of doing some top secret, whatever, thingamajig, whatever. And you'll just be sitting there as a player, like, what in the hell? Like, what is this trying to prove? Like, sometimes I just feel like that series is just like, yep, yeah, we know you know a lot about fucking movies, Kojima.
That's the thing. I mean, I think this series is a great joke.
It is.
It's really funny. It's a better joke than it is a game. In terms of actual gameplay, it was okay at first. I think 3 was the apex, and by the time they got to 4, it's like, what the hell? Because in 4, they put a lot of effort into refining the controls and making the gunplay a lot better, and they did, but it also marginalizes what made that game interesting in the first place, which is sneaking around and trying not to be seen.
Yeah.
Which you can do, but there's no reason to do it anymore,
yeah,
basically.
In 4, I also really never understood the whole online component of it. It's just janky to play with those controls, like play against other players with the controls. It's just so horrible.
Well, I mean, other players aren't going to be fooled by pieces of cardboard lying around either.
Yeah.
No, I think Assassin's Creed figured out how to do that much better.
Yeah, like having to just how you switch from like knife to gun and all that kind of stuff. Like you just can't do it quickly enough to make it a worthwhile deathmatch experience.
The controls are atrocious across the entire series.
Yeah, pretty much.
You're going to have to deal with that. If you're a controls whore like me, you're really going to have to grit your teeth through these games. I'm telling you right now.
Yep.
All right, let's wrap up this podcast, guys. Thanks to everybody for writing in. Again, the email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We also, of course, have new episodes of the newscast. And in fact, they are on the lookout for a podcast editor to help them keep the show going. So if you have a little bit of audio skill and a lot of time and you like the newscast and you'd like to help out, let them know. Go to the website. There's a post up about it, or just contact us and we'll put you in the right hands. But they are looking for some help over there. And there is finally a new episode of Radio Trivia with 2IP joining Nicholas Bray from Australia. And they put together a really, really fun episode, actually. I just listened to it today, and it's good stuff. So be sure to check that out as well if you like video game music. Finally, before we go, don't forget, next week is the big 250th anniversary episode, and you can be a part of it. Just check out the website on Saturday, July 9th at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, or 7 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, and we'll have a chat room and a live stream there, and you can be on the show. We'll have a call-in info over Skype, so if you want to be a part of the show, make sure you have Skype set up, bring a decent microphone, Rock Band Guitar Hero works pretty well, and we would love to talk with you about whatever you want. Looking forward to it, guys, so help us celebrate, and we'll have a really good time. That's it. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week. The reason, it's kind of funny, but the reason that I bring up specifically jetpacks and grappling hooks so often is because they're sort of game design commodities that you can add into a lot of different kinds of games.
Trauma Center.
Whereas the dash in Mega Man X,
Dr. Octopus. Enjoy your independence, America, while it lasts.
Happy Canada Day.
Canada Day. Gotta come up with a better name for your holidays than Canada Day.
Oh.